if we were to take a look at our practice, our hanhagos of the different, on the different special occasions that we have during the year, Yom Tovim, so one can generally identify a particular mitzvah that's associated with the Yom Tov, and a particular feeling that one is supposed to have during the course of the Yom Tov, often identified in the davening itself. And so, we come to Pesach, for example, we declare in the davening in the Kiddush, it's Yom Chag HaMatzos Hazeh Zman Cheruseinu. And this teaches us that the mitzvah, of course, the Maisa HaMitzvah, Achilas Matzah, whether it's just at the Seder, the whole week, Machlokas, whether one is required to eat matzah during the course of the week, not the discussion for right now, but certainly Achilas Matzah is the mitzvah, the Maisa HaMitzvah, the act of the mitzvah that's identified with Pesach. And it says, Zman Cheruseinu, the feeling that one is supposed to express or have is the feeling of Cherus, the feeling of freedom, and that's what characterizes Pesach. And we say, on Sukkot, Yom Chag HaSukkot, says Zman Simchoseinu, again, the mitzvah of sitting in the Sukkah is the dominant mitzvah of Yom Tov Sukkot. We also have the mitzvah to wave the Lulav Esrei, but that's only the first day. According to the Torah, the mitzvah of Sukkot is all week long. And so that's the mitzvah that is the, that's the Maisa HaMitzvah, as it were, the act of the mitzvah that is required on Sukkot. And Simcha is the inner feeling that one is supposed to have when it comes to the Yom Tov Sukkot. I skipped over Shavuos. Intentionally, Shavuos is a broader discussion, but we refer to Yom Chag HaShavuos as a Zman Matan Toraseinu. There's no, not exactly a Maisa HaMitzvah associated directly with the Yom Tov of Shavuos, and that's again for another discussion, except the idea that was the whole build-up, the weeks, the counting, the Siris HaOmer and so on, culminating in Shavuos, that's perhaps the Maisa HaMitzvah that relates to Shavuos, and the feeling that one is supposed to have is the commitment to Torah, Zman Matan Toraseinu, and so on. And even when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaZikar, Yom Truah, Yom HaZikaron, again a reference to the Maisa HaMitzvah, the Shofar, although there it's in a different order, again for another discussion. And at the time we focus on being remembered by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, thinking about the connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Zichronos, and so on. And Yom Kippur, Yom HaKippurim, which is again the Maisa HaMitzvah, relates to fasting and to the other Inuim of Yom Kippur, and at the time Mechila, Slicha, Kapara, those the experiences. And so that's the, again, you can look at each one, and now is not the appropriate time to discuss Yom Tovim, but we get the sense that Yom Tovim are associated in general with a Maisa Mitzvah or the Kiyama Mitzvah. Now, the Mitzvahs Midarabonon, the Yom Tovim rather, Midarabonon, take a look, we're obviously modeled in the same sense after the Daraisas called the Tikkun Rabbanon came, the Daraisa Tikkun, Chazal always modeled the, their Tikkunas and their Exeus and their Dinim after already existing formulae in the Torah. So when it comes to Yom Tovim as well, so we find with regards to Purim, well obviously we don't have reference, there's no Kiddush on Purim, there's no reference in the Shemoneh Esrei, there's no special bracha and so on in the Shemoneh Esrei on Purim. Nevertheless, we have the Maisa HaMitzvah of Purim of Kriyas HaMegillah and the other mitzvahs of the day, but more dominantly perhaps Kriyas HaMegillah, and the sense of the feeling of Simcha that a person has, a different kind of Simcha than on Sukkot and the other Yom Tovim, perhaps a more unbridled Simcha, a Simcha associated with Basar Yayin, at least with some sort of a Suda and so on, and with interacting with other people. Those are the themes that one should focus on when it comes to Purim and Chanukah. We have the Maisa Mitzvah, Adlokas Neiris, Chanukah, and then we have the sense of that these are Yemei Hallel V'Hodah, like the Gemara says in Shabbat. So what happens when it comes to Tisha B'Av? When it comes to Tisha B'Av, which actually ironically is referred to in Megillas Eicha, read last night, as a Moed as well, and that's an instructive point. There is a Moed aspect to Tisha B'Av also. As an aside, the Sfas Emes, in a number of places, identifies the idea that Tisha B'Av gives us the opportunity to feel what we would have felt on the Moadim had there been a Beis HaMikdash. I alluded to the fact last night that one of the things which was accomplished. When Jews came on the Shalosh Regalim to Yerushalayim, so they sent the Shekhinah, they had peace of mind, as we discussed last night, and in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, we don't have it, but by crying, the Shalosh is right, by missing this on Tisha B'Av, by focusing on this absence on Tisha B'Av, so we're able to gain certain spiritual heights that were accomplished by going to be Ola Regal, by going to Yerushalayim to the Beis HaMikdash on Shalosh Regal, and we're able to accomplish that on Tisha B'Av. That's how the Sosemis explains the Moed aspect of Tisha B'Av. By the way, as we know, it has certain halachic ramifications, so perhaps paradoxically, we don't say Tachanun on Tisha B'Av, we didn't say Tachanun yesterday at Mincha already, as is the practice when approaching Yontif. So there is this Yontif aspect or Moed aspect to Tisha B'Av. But what is the Maisa HaMitzvah, so to speak? So it's a little difficult to identify a positive Maisa Mitzvah, but again, in a sense, similar to Yom Kippur, we have restrictions that apply on Tisha B'Av, the Chameshas Inuyim, and those things that we avoid doing on Tisha B'Av, Mitam Avelos, sitting on the floor, and various other behaviors that are identified with someone, Rachman Al-Fan, was observing Shiva. But there is as well the creation of the mood. There's the Maisa Mitzvah, as you would mention, with regard to the other Avim Tovim, there's a certain mood that is to prevail. And we explained in the past that the Soloveitchik noted that the recitation of Kinnus is the creation of that mood that is supposed to prevail on Tisha B'Av. I'd like to elaborate that for a moment in a different way than perhaps we've done in the past. Again, I mentioned last night that every person's neshama is at least in some sense, at some point, tormented, and perhaps tortured even. And Baruch Hashem, we don't focus on that most of the time, we live our lives, but all of us at one time or another are bothered by certain questions and have difficulties with deep philosophical questions, the simpler questions about, you know, why me, or why this happened to me in my life, and so on, and we struggle with that. And one of the ways which one can deal or cope with a certain internal struggle that takes place within the neshama is through verbalization, through talking something out, through amira, through speaking. And certainly in the realm of the psychology, psychiatry, so one thing people are encouraged to do is to identify the problem, to talk about it, and to speak things out, and that brings a certain, perhaps a cathartic quality to it, and so on. And the truth is, perhaps you can suggest that this is what the kinos really are all about. The kinos are about expressing disappointment, expressing questions, and that's really what I'll try and highlight perhaps this year in a slightly different fashion than maybe in past years, but try and focus at least on each kina on one or two themes that are alluded to in the, or even specified clearly in the kina, as a means of giving each other and ourselves the opportunity to sort of speak something out. We know that the capacity to speak is unique to human beings. Chazal tell us that the verbalization is the ability to verbalize something is the crowning achievement of man's ability as opposed to that of the animals. The Torah itself, when describing the creation of man, describes man as nefesh chaya, which the Targum identifies as ruach m'malala, the ability to speak, the ability to make requests, the ability to express intelligent thought. The Gemara in the beginning of Masechet Bava Kama has an unusual word. The Mishnah describes different types of damaging agents that can cause damage. It speaks about animals causing damage and about pits or some other obstacle that one is placed in a public place causing damage, fire causing damage. And the Mishnah uses the word maveh. Mave is one of the Arba Oz Nezikim, Ashur, Rabor, Raham, Mave, the Hever. So sure we understand that it's an animal, a boar is a pit, a Hever relates to fire, but what's Mave exactly? So the Gemara has a dispute. So it's such an unusual word, the Gemara has a dispute. But one explanation of Mave is that Mave represents Adam, Adam HaMazer, the Chokas Rabban Shmuel, but it's about, one opinion is that it refers to other hamas. Another opinion is a different type of damage done by animals, the different categories of damage done by animals. So that's one opinion. But the other opinion is that maver refers to human being, and there's a pasuk which the Gemara cites there. It's one of the psukim that people know from the Gemara, not from the Tanakh. But it says there, in tivoyon ba'oyu, Amar Shama asaboka in tivoyon ba'oyu. And it's a pasuk in Navi, and it describes a man in that regard as a creature that can ask, in tivoyon ba'oyu, a creature that can ask or seek through the verbal word. And therefore, we find that man's ability to verbalize is what characterizes man. I'm not saying we know that today they know that animals can also communicate, but clearly not in anywhere near resembling the level on which man can communicate and the man's ability to exchange ideas and so on. So it's perhaps with that in mind that the practice developed over the centuries, and certainly as time went on, more and more kinos were composed, presumably because, unfortunately, there were more and more disasters to compose kinos about, and it's become more or less standard, different practice. I shouldn't say it's actually standard throughout all Jewish communities. I have at home a kinos booklet for the minhag of the Sfaradim, and the piyutim are different. Most of the kinos are different than the ones that we recite among the Ashkenazim. It's become more or less a standard selection that we say among the Ashkenazim. But our purpose then, to come around to what I said before, is to use this capacity to speak, this capacity to communicate, to not necessarily share ideas with somebody else, but rather to express the torment, so to speak, of the neshama. And that's what the kinos accomplish. Now, in a certain sense, one can ask, well, does it do any good? After all, when kinos are over, and indeed when Tisha B'Av is over, the Beis HaMikdash has not been rebuilt. Perhaps it'll change this year, but in past years certainly it hasn't happened. And one can get perhaps an empty feeling, as opposed to, as again I alluded to last night, as opposed to, let's say, at the end of Yom Kippur, a person has a feeling of having been cleansed, a person has a feeling of you went through something, it was difficult, it was challenging, we went through something, but there's a positive result, there's something I accomplished. Sometimes I think one can wonder, what did we accomplish by saying the kinos? We're not any better off necessarily than we were beforehand. However, I'm not sure that's the case. I think, again, in the realm of psychological well-being and health, the very idea of being able to talk something out is considered to be healthy, as a general rule. It's considered to be something that will assist one. And perhaps on Tisha B'Av, all year long, the truth is the mitzvah, of course, to mourn the Beis HaMikdash is not limited to Tisha B'Av. Actually, the Shulchan Aruch says that it's proper for a person to be meitzer, to be disturbed right at the beginning, in the very beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim. It says that on a regular basis, a person should note the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. There are some pious people who every night say Tikkun Chatzos and so on. And those who have looked at the beginning of the Siddur and see Tikkun Chatzos know that the focus of Tikkun Chatzos is to mourn the Churban. And there, I don't know how many people say Tikkun Chatzos, but there are certain pious individuals, Arei HaMazeh, who do say Tikkun Chatzos and mourn the Beis HaMikdash daily, and we, those of us who don't, but we still make reference to the Shulchan Aruch, the Shulchan Aruch, Barachim, and Toshuv, and so on. So we don't miss the Beis HaMikdash only on Tisha B'Av. However, in terms of actually spelling out and sort of trying to focus on what the Beis HaMikdash was, and what the Yerushalayim once was, and how we feel devastated by its absence, so that's limited more or less for most of us to Tisha B'Av itself. And therefore, even as we can point to the fact that there's not much closure, in a certain sense, after Tisha B'Av, because we don't necessarily feel that the Beis HaMikdash is necessarily any closer than it was before, that the Geula is any closer than it was before, still, the opportunity to talk out, the opportunity to speak, is something which is beneficial, and it gives us the ability to sort of share with HaKadosh Baruch Hu how we feel. Now, the feeling that we have sometimes is anger, and there are kinnis which reflect anger, and there's a feeling sometimes of puzzlement, of how could such a thing happen. But yes, on Tisha B'Av we're allowed to express that. How do we know we're allowed to express that? Because Yirmiyahu HaNavi expressed it. Eicha. Eicha is, in a certain sense, a challenge, as it were, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eicha, how could such a thing happen? And take a look, there's so many psukim in Megillah, take a look at who you did this to, and how could you do this, and what happened to this? And we'll see as we go through the kinos, and that's why I said I'm going to focus on a theme in each kino, we'll see in each kino that that's exactly what sometimes we're doing. We have a license from Yirmiyahu, we have a license from Eicha to ask, and to voice our question, and to, in effect, almost challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu and make demands, and ask him why he did this, and how can he do this, and how long is it going to be, and so on. Things that we ordinarily would not necessarily think are respectful and appropriate, but the fact remains that since Yirmiyahu did it, so we take our license from him. Furthermore, the Haftarah that we just read, so the Navi says that there comes a time when you need to call the experts. Hashem said, contemplate, summon the women who know how to sing dirges, and let them come, and send to the wise women, and let them come, and hurry and raise the lament for us, so that our eyes will run with tears, and our pupils flow with water. Sometimes we can't express how we feel. Sometimes even an intelligent person, and even a person with great oratory abilities and so on, has a difficulty expressing feelings, especially when you're suffering. And so sometimes you have to turn to experts. That's what the pasuk says. Well, you have to motivate people to cry. Yeah, kiril amikonos, summon the experts who know how to say kinos. So that's another thing we do also. We take out the experts. The experts are the Rabbeinu Kalir and the other great composers of the kinos who knew how to express thoughts and very poetic. I mean, you know, many of the kinos have these intricate arrangements based on psukim and the aleph bays and wrapping things in different ways and three different stanzas for each letter and different things that are all identified, as you take a look at the kinos. But those are the experts. So sometimes we need help expressing our feelings, expressing what we should feel, and that's also the purpose of the kinos. We don't even know, we know kind of inside there's something we're supposed to feel, but sometimes it's difficult to articulate it, and so the kinos are the, so to speak, the works of the experts who are providing us with that assistance. The first kino I just want to call again, as opposed to in past years, where I sort of referred to different lines, maybe just pick one theme. And that is here, the opening kinah starts with the words Shavas, Suru, Meni, Shinuno, Ovrai, or Okrai, different versions. The word is Shavas. So that word is obviously familiar to us, and Shabbos, Elashi, Shavas, Vayinafash, and so on, Vayishbos. The idea, I think, of this, at least this phrase, and this is one theme of kinos, is to contemplate the fact that everything stopped. The things aren't as they were. And that's, I think, the theme I want to focus on for a moment with this first kinos, Shavas. Everything has changed. The Beis HaMikdash is gone. Things aren't the same as they were before. I think if you contemplate for a moment, Rachmana Litzlan, when a person is sitting Shiva after the death of a close relative, so one of the things that the person feels is that, wow, my life is not going to be the same anymore. Things have changed, and it's not going to go back, at least not in the foreseeable future, to the way it was before. That's the idea of Shavas. When a person feels an intense loss, you recognize, that it's like the clock stopped. It's like everything's different. The whole world is different. I remember once hearing a story, a report, I believe that it was Yaakov Kamenetsky was delivering a hesped to the late Satmar Rav, the old Teitelbaum, and I believe that that's who the speaker was, and that's whose hesped it was. And he noted the fact that there's a pasuk in Navi and Amos, which says, which speaks about the sun setting in midday. And what's interesting is that the Gemara actually uses that pasuk when they're describing the Levi of Rabbi Yochanan, and it's like the sun set in the middle of the day. Now, said of Yaakov, it's understandable to apply that pasuk at a hesped or levaya, rachman l'tzlan, for a young person who passes away, shalom be'ito. And you know, sometimes the rachman l'tzlan, a young person dies, and the sense is that the sun set in the middle of the day, the person still had the whole rest of his life in front of him, and rachman l'tzlan, whatever tragedy took place, so he died in the middle of the day, and that would be understand the parallel or the reason to cite that pasuk that speaks about the sun setting in midday. However, said Rabbi Yaakov, the Gemara applies that the death of Rabbi Yochanan, who lived to 120 years old. So why that particular pasuk? And so again, I hope I'm quoting the right people. I believe it was Rabbi Yaakov who suggested the following. The comparison to the sun setting in the middle of the day is the following. How do I know that the sun is going to come up tomorrow morning? The answer is because it came up this morning, and yesterday morning, and previous day's morning, and every morning. And it's going to set tonight, and it'll set tomorrow night, and so on. When the sun sets in the middle of the day, however, such an unusual occurrence, so then I'm not so sure the sun's going to rise tomorrow morning. Because it didn't set at the normal time, who knows what's going to be. And therefore, the pasuk as described, you know, used the time of death of Yochanan was not so much the sun setting early in the sense of a young person dying at an earlier time, but rather things have changed now. Who knows what's going to be tomorrow? Who knows what's coming up next? Everything we took for granted and everything we assumed was going to be all of a sudden is not the way it was. The sun set in the middle of the day. So now Yochanan's gone. So what's going to be tomorrow morning? Who's going to give the shiur? Who's going to teach us and so on? And that, I believe, again, as I said, was Rabbi Yaakov Zichron Baruch Hu said the time of the death of the Satmar Rav, Gadol B'Torah, the sun set him away. He wasn't so young. He wasn't young when he passed away. But for those people who were his Talmidim and his followers and so on and so forth, you wake up the next day and wonder what's going to be now. Everything that you thought was part of a natural order, the way things were, so we've grown accustomed to, and we used to, all of a sudden everything changed. I think that's one theme. Hinted at least in the opening phrase of this particular kina, shavas, a person, things stopped functioning the way we expected them to, and so therefore one idea of reciting kinas on Tisha B'Av and one theme of Tisha B'Av is that things with the time of the Churban changed, and so far it's not come back. We've not ever had that opportunity once again. Life changed, and so we too should express at this time our sense, as we recite kinos, that there's something missing that hasn't yet been restored. It's not business as usual. It's not just doing what we ordinarily do, because we never know. And, you know, people know the English expression, you know, life can change in the blink of an eye, right? All of a sudden, everything you expected, everything you thought, can change in one split second. Everything that you had worked for and everything you had anticipated, you know, in the snap of a finger can change. And that's again a tortured. It's a tortured neshama, so to speak. Comes to that realization that everything you thought and everything you assumed can change in just a moment, and not necessarily ever really come back to the way it was before. And I'm sure all of us can reflect on life experiences that we've had where certain things happen that we didn't necessarily expect. And the challenge, of course, is to cope with it, to make the best of it, and so on. That's perhaps one theme of this very first kin, and a theme that was Tisha B'Av as well. Shalom, Surah Meni, Shemunah Hoffman. Next kin begins, Echa Atzta V'Yatecha. Here we have as the theme in the kin of the phrase, Zechor Hashem Mehayolana, which is a pasuk in the last parak of Echa. And we have, in line with what I said before, in terms of the power of the verbal expression, every stanza ends with another word for speaking. V'chein bitinu, proclaimed, dibarnu, spoken, v'koneinu, lamented, chivinu, related, all the words, all the verbs that are spelled out at the end of each stanza are different words for speaking. Again, highlighting the notion that we just mentioned of speech being the sort of the dominant theme of the recitation of kinos. Again, to look at one phrase, Echa Atzto V'Apecha, the opening phrase, how do you rush? Atz is relates to rushing, to moving with great speed. And the truth is that I mentioned this at I believe on Shabbos Chazon and Shal Shudas, that sometimes it's bad enough that we do averes, but we actually sometimes rush to do them. We're very quick to do Averis. I mentioned the comment of Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz in the Haftorah for Shabbos Chazon, where it says, and I'm going to repeat it for those who weren't around for Shal Shudas, it says in the Haftorah for Shabbos Chazon, regarding Yerushalayim, Tzedek Yolim Bo V'Atzom Aratzim. Tzedek Yolim Bo, the simple pshat is that Tzedek at one time, Yerushalayim was known for Tzedek, for righteousness. Tzedek Yolim Bo is a place where righteousness can be found, V'Atzom, but now, Atzom V'Ayim. Now Maratzachim, now there are murders there. And this draws a contrast between what Yerushalayim was and had become. However, Yonasan Eibeshitz notes that it's a general comment as well, that very often when it comes to doing good things, so Tzedek Yolim Bo, we'll sleep on it, we've got to think about it for a while. Right? We said in a joking way, we'll have to commission a study, we'll put together a committee, and then we'll decide whether it's the right thing to do, it's a good thing to do, it's not a good thing to do. That's when it's when we're talking about doing a mitzvah, something positive. But when it comes to something bad, so then we'll do it right away. You know, hang the guy right now. Right? So Tzedek Yolim Bo, when it comes to Tzedek, so we'll take our time. When it comes to Meratzim, it's Atah. And that's, I mentioned that we say in the Al-Chais and in Kippur, one of them is Ritzas, Al-Chais and Chalom HaRechim, Ritzas Raglayim Lahara. Not only did we do bad things, Ritzas, we ran to do it. We did it with alacrity, the sense of passion. And here, Eicha Atzta Ba'Pecha, the suggestion is, or the complaint that HaKadosh Baruch Hu here is, you went ahead and behaved that way to us, you rushed to sort of thing, rushed to judgment. Of course, it's not true in a deep sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't really rush to judgment, but we have the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't pause to give us a break, as it were, or to consider the positives. He did. But the sense of loss is that there wasn't quite enough time, quite enough thought given to it. And again, when a person has a terrible tragedy takes place in his life, so you feel like, how come I would have only had another couple of minutes, or if we would have just delayed, or if only this would have happened, or that would have come out slightly different, everything would have been okay. And that's the sense expressed in this kinah, at least again at the beginning, Eicha Atzta Ba'Pecha. Bad things have happened and we feel that, we lost the opportunity perhaps to weigh things over or to have things thought about and calculated, but rather we rush to judgment, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu rushed to judgment. Even if it's not true, sometimes that's how we think. If a terrible thing happens at work, a person gets fired, or a person has something bad happens in the workforce, and we think, oh, if only I would have had the opportunity to sit with a person, talk it over a little bit, would have had a few more minutes, everything was just so rushed. That's the expression that we have here in this kinah, Eicha Atzta Ba'Pecha. Eicha Atzta Ba'Pecha. The next kinah, Adar Chuk Shamayim, has at the end of each stanza a pasuk or something based on a pasuk with the word me in it. So you look at the end of the first stanza, Es Onen Mi Yitain Rosh Yimayim. In the art school edition, the word me is highlighted. Eshag Mi Yitnei Vamidbar Aroshem Mi Yitnei Shamir Vashayim. And so on. I think here, another theme that we think about in kinnas, and also again, in line with what we're saying, when we feel wronged or we feel hurt, in general, we ask, who did this to me? And who is responsible for this? If something goes wrong, we ask, who is it that caused this to happen? Sometimes we do that because we want to blame somebody else. It's a lot easier to say that it was someone else's fault than to say it's our fault. But sometimes also it's, I think, an expression of amazement. This person, whom I was so close, I feel betrayed and so on. And how could it be that you of all people did this? Indeed, again, in Megillas Eichon, as I mentioned before, that's where we take our cue from in terms of raising some of these questions. It says that the foreign nations and leaders did not believe that such a thing could happen to Shalom, and they rejoiced over the fact that you did this, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? You, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, did this. And part of the sort of astonishment and disappointment
comes that here was someone that I trusted, and the person betrayed me. So therefore, that's perhaps a theme of this kinnah, when we say, me, who is it that did such a thing? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, of course, like many of the kinnahs, it ends with a positive note, me tain mitzion shuas Yisrael, and there the word doesn't mean who in that sense, because me also sometimes, and again other places as well, in this kinnah means would that, I wish that would happen. And nonetheless, I think that it's a significant point, again, from both aspects. Number one, when we ask the question of who did this, and when we hear the answer, we're stunned, and sometimes we have that feeling of betrayal. And sometimes, again, we ask the question who, because we don't want to blame ourselves. And that's also, again, a theme in the kinnos, based on a pasuk that we'll address in one of the later kinnos, that says, how could such a thing happen, that mothers would... unfortunately, consume the flesh of their own children, the pasuk said in Megillas Eichah, and their answer is, well, we killed the Kohen and Navi and then the Beis HaMikdash at the same time, again, from a later kinnah. Very often you ask the question, whose fault is this and who did this? And you're really honest with yourself, you realize it was your own doing, and you're to blame yourself, and just asking who is a matter of deflecting and looking to blame somebody else. But again, I also think that the question who is a question of astonishment. And we're just amazed that such a thing could happen, especially when we trusted somebody and then the person turned and betrayed us. And again, that's perhaps the theme of this kinnah, in terms of the emphasis of the word me. Next kinnah, number 9, begins, Echa sif'arti me'ashosai hishlichu. Again, in this particular kina, each stanza ends with a phrase from Parshas B'chukosai, but I want to focus for a moment on the opening phrase, Echa tif'arti merashosai yishlichu. That's a pasuk, or based on a pasuk in Echa, it says, Hishlich mishamayim eretz tiferes Israel. Now, what is meant by tiferes? Tiferes is glory. Tiferes is beauty, glory, like we find with the Big Day Kahuna of us and Big Day Kosh, La'aron Achicha Lechavod Ul'sifaras. Right, Tiferes is beauty, sort of like a deep kind of beauty or glory, splendor perhaps, different English words. And what happens all of a sudden is that we find that the splendor has been cast down, has been thrown to the ground. Yishlich mishamayim eretz tiferes Yisrael. What's the idea here? I think perhaps the contrast or the point here is wasted potential. And Klal Yisrael and individuals within Klal Yisrael have the opportunity to achieve the greatest glory. Man in general has the opportunity to reach the heights of success and the heights of glory. And indeed, that's in this particular kinnah, every stanza has this psukim from Parshas B'chukosai, all can be terrific. In B'chukosai Telechu, B'nosati Gishmeichem B'itam, have rain in the proper season, B'sigochem Daishas Batsir, right, the different seasons will overlap in such a way there'll be so much produce and so much vegetation available, etc. B'nosati Shalom Aretz, there'll be peace, and you'll defeat anybody who starts up with you, and I will dwell in the midst, B'nosati Mishkani. Right, these are all the wonderful things. But then in the middle, the kina goes to the second part of Parshas B'chukosai, as to what happens in the reverse case. Los Yishmo, and it speaks about Kadosh Baruch Hu breaking down our strength, and Mishvarti has gone, V'sam Lorik, that we'll end up using all our strength for nothing, and V'shlachti Rechem Eschaya, the animals will attack, all the terrible things. And again, this kina is a sort of a contrast, I think, in general, in terms of the history of Klal Yisrael, the potential of Klal Yisrael to be at the highest height, but the times have sometimes sunk very, very low, but not only in terms of Klal Yisrael, but in terms of individuals as well. You know, one of the puzzling phrases that appears in the beginning of the Chumash is the phrase, Nasa Adam, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates men, so he speaks in the plural, he says, Nasa Adam, let us make man. And that's, of course, as Rashi already knows, it's a very problematical thing, especially when you're trying to deal with those people who believe that there's more than one God or more than one manifestation of God, and we categorically reject such a concept. We say, Hashem HaKeno Hashem Echad. So, you know, what is meant by Nasa Adam? It sure sounds like Kadosh Baruch Hu was consulting somebody else, or perhaps a different manifestation or a different God. And so there are different answers as to what is meant by Na'aseh Adam. Rashi has his approach, Ramban has a different answer. But one of the answers may be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was speaking to man himself, Na'aseh Adam. He's speaking to Adam himself and said, let us make man, meaning you and me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to man, says to Adam, you and me together. What does it mean? It means HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives everybody certain natural innate abilities and talents. Everybody has his or her natural talents and abilities. However, it becomes left up to the person to decide what he's going to do with those natural abilities and talents. And as we know, some people use them for good, constructive purposes and are very successful. Others use it for bad things, and others don't use it at all. You hear all the time about wasted potential. This person has the potential to be such a successful, you know, sometimes you speak as a teacher and you meet with parents, at the parent-teachers conferences, and you said his child has so much potential, he could, really be successful, only put a little more work, or behave better, or be a little lazy, or study more for the test, or whatever it is. And, it's always a source of anguish when you see somebody's got the potential and he doesn't go anywhere with it. And the same thing is true of a nation. A nation has potential. We have the potential to reach great levels of tiferes, glory, splendor, but we were cast down, so to speak, and end up being the very bottom of the heap. And that's unfortunately what has been the lot of Klal Yisrael for all these years. A nation which was respected, and the Beis HaMikdash was a place that was visited by even non-Jewish people. The Beis HaMikdash was the center of a religion that people respected. We know that even Alexander the Great respected the Jewish religion. He wanted to make a new culture where he would take the best of the different cultures and religions, but certainly respected that there was what to offer from the Jewish people, from the Jewish traditions and so on. So respected. But at the same time, as a people, no one's been more downtrodden. No one's been more oppressed throughout the history of the world for such an extended period of time like we have. And that's the idea of this kinah. We're in a position of tiferes, of glory, of splendor. Again, I say it relates both to the individual and to the nation, and the contrast is sharpened within this kinah by the contrast within the psukim b'chukosa. You have the potential for everything to go well, and everything to be good. There'll be plenty of rain, there'll be peace. And on the flip side, unfortunately, the thing is, when we don't listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we get punished, and we sink to the depth. That's certainly, as I say, a theme of Tisha B'Av, the contrast between, what potentially could be, and indeed what once was, and what has become, unfortunately, today. The next kina, Echa Yoshua Chavatzelos Hashoron, is a kina in which the families of the Kohanim are identified by the names of the Kohanim. The Gemara teaches in the end of Maseches Tainis that in the days of before the Beit HaMikdash, in the days of David HaMelech and the Shmuel HaNavi, the avoda in the Beit HaMikdash was set up in such a way that different families were on duty different weeks. After all, you don't need all the Kohanim in the world to be present in the Beis HaMikdash every single day. There's not that much to do. And obviously as time went on, there were more and more Kohanim available. And therefore they set up a system of 24 Mishmaros, the Mishmaros Kehuna, and every Mishmar served for 1 week. They were on duty that week, and then they left and went back home and engaged in whatever they were engaged in. There were teachers and other things, but they weren't in the Beis HaMikdash except for that 1 week. And on a rotational basis, every week was a different group until that group's turn came around. Except Yom Tovim, all hands were needed and so on because of the throng of people that attended and so on. I suggest that perhaps since we're talking about the 24 Mishmaros, and again, by the way, this is presented already in, it's based on Psukim in Ksuvim, in Divra HaYamim Aleph, where every group's name is mentioned, so those are the names that are appearing at the end of each different stanza, the name of the different Mishmaros, based on family names. But I think that there perhaps is something lesson here also of the importance of having a position and or having a post, so to speak, and carrying out your duties in an effective manner. The Kohanim are praised here, perhaps, and we've mentioned this in the past, as Soloveitchik said, because when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, they really fought the hardest to prevent that from happening. We've mentioned that the breach into the old city of Yerushalayim happened on Shavuos of Tammuz, 17th of Tammuz, beginning of the 3 weeks. It took 3 weeks for them to get to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. What in the world took so long? You can walk it today in 10 minutes. You know, what took so long? That took 3 weeks from the time that you would assume. From the time they broke into the city, it should have been a matter of a day or two till they were able to conquer the compound of the Beis HaMikdash and burn it down. But it didn't. It took 3 full weeks. And that, Soloveitchik suggested, because the Kohanim, together with others, but perhaps led by the Kohanim, fought, you know, valiantly to prevent the Beis HaMikdash from being destroyed. And therefore the Kohanim are given credit here. Also, in a certain sense, the Kohanim lost more than anybody else, because most of the Kedusha, the Kohen, that distinguishes the Kohen from other people, revolved around the Beis HaMikdash. While we still have Kedusha Kohuna today, it's not the same in terms of, you know, what the Kohen is eligible to do. But the idea of standing at a post, the idea of maintaining a position and carrying out a job properly, I think is an important theme of this particular kinnah. Every person has a certain assignment in life, and the assignment has many, many different components to it. But a person has to know what his particular assignment is. Sometimes there's trouble when a person attempts to carry out an assignment that's not his, because he may not be qualified. How many times have we witnessed or seen or heard about people who got involved in things they weren't really qualified to get involved in and ended up doing a lot more damage than good? But besides that, on the flip side, a person has to maintain his own post and make sure that what he's supposed to do, he's doing. And that's what the Kohanim did. They had this rotational system, and every week the different families showed up. That's what's mentioned in this kinnah. And perhaps it's a lament, in a certain sense, over the fact that sometimes people do not carry out their responsibilities in the appropriate fashion, and it's the detriment of themselves and the detriment of the community. I remember, I can't remember now, it was 2 or 3 cycles ago of the Daf Yomi, I attended the Siyum of Schwab Zichron Baruch, who was still alive at that time, of Shimon Schwab of the Breuer's Kehillah, Das Yishuv in Washington Heights. And Schwab was one of the speakers at the Siyum. This was at the Madison Square Garden. I don't remember which cycle it was. I think it was a couple of cycles ago. So Rav Schwab mentioned regarding Daf Yomi that a person who learns the Daf is like a soldier at a post. You can't just leave. And if your position is a soldier at a particular post, you're responsible for what's going on over there. You can't just decide, okay, I'm going to take off for a half hour now and go take a rest or go grab a bite. If you're assigned at a particular post, you have to carry out your responsibilities at that post. I remember he compared that to people learning the Daf Yomi. You know, you miss a day, you fall behind. It's like a soldier leaving his post. Well, I think we can extend that not only to the study of Daf Yomi, but to our responsibilities in general. If a person abandons his post, so very often there are very, very negative consequences that follow. And we struggle, again, I speak to myself also, we struggle in life sometimes, trying to balance everything and have everything work out, our responsibilities to our job and to the people we associate with, to balance that with our responsibility to our family, to raising children and so on. These are all, it's not easy. And I think one way you have to look at it is like a soldier at his post. You can't abandon the post. You've got to carry out your responsibility. This kin, as I say, is a tribute to the Kohanim who did that. Again, the question, of course, is, or the point, of course, is that it no longer exists, and it doesn't, so that's the sadness. But again, this other message, I think, this hidden message, is, I think, very, very important to us, that a person has to be at a post, has a responsibility, and has to find a way to carry out the responsibility in the proper way, difficult though it is. And again, sometimes we're tortured by it, sometimes we're anguished by it, because there are things we'd like to do but can't do, there are things we think we can do and really we can't do. Again, there's a lot to say about it, but Perhaps this auxiliary theme of this kina is that a person like the Kohanim has to know what his mission is and carry out his particular mission or her particular mission in the best possible fashion. Now the next kina, Vayikonen Yirmiyahu al Yoshiyahu, is actually based on the fact that the pasuk tells us in Ksuvim, Divrei Hayamim Beis, that Yirmiyahu Hanavi himself asked the Jewish people to recite a kina upon the death of Yoshiyahu. Again, the story of Yoshiyahu very briefly. Yoshiyahu was the grandson of a king by the name of Menasseh, who basically, in the early part of his life anyway, made every effort to eradicate Torah observance from within Klal Yisrael. Actually, later on, he did tshuva at the end of his life, but that's for another discussion. But basically, his mission was successful in that people were not even familiar with many, many basics of Torah observance. And in fact, many, many people apparently never had even seen a complete sacred Torah. That's how complete the abandonment of Torah was in the days of Menasseh. And the Navi describes that a Kohen Gadol by the name of Chilkiyahu, perhaps the father of Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyahu was Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu, discovered, quote-unquote, a copy of the sacred Torah that had been in the Beis HaMikdash, which at that time was in a state of disrepair. And when they started to do certain renovations, as it were, in the Beis HaMikdash, so they found a hidden Sefer Torah, and Chilkiyahu noted that the Sefer Torah was open to the Tochacha in Parshas Kisavo, where it says, Ora Shalayakim is Divya Torah Zozon, so it's Osom. And when Yoshiyahu heard about this, he was devastated, and he realized that he has to do what needs to be done to reinvigorate the Jewish people's spirit with that of Torah, and he did so. And actually, he was able, in a span really of not that long, maybe 10 years or so, was able to turn everything around such that now the Jewish people who had been so far removed from Torah had become very, very observant. It was a mass about tshuva movement, so to speak. And this was all to the tribute to the great king Yoshiyahu. Now, Yoshiyahu then made a very unfortunate mistake. There was a war going on that didn't initially impact the Jewish people at all. It's not an accident that where Eretz Yisrael is called the Middle East. It's a good description, the Middle East, because really it's the middle of all the action. And it was always like that. If we think of the ancient times, there were often two great empires, in the north. North of Eretz Yisrael, and Egypt was always a great empire to the south of Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael was always in the middle. We know this from this Hanukkah time, when Alexander the Great conquered, Alexander the Great, for the time he was alive, had the Greek Empire ruling as one empire. But after his death, his successors were unable to hold the empire together, and therefore kind of split initially into three and subsequently into two parts. One based in the north of Eretz Yisrael in Syria, and one based in the south of Eretz Yisrael in Egypt, and these two groups often warred against each other. Again, it was like that in ancient times too, a Babylonian Empire and the Egyptian Empire, and Eretz Yisrael was always in the middle. And in the days of Yoshiyahu, what happened was there was a war taking place between Egypt, Mitzrayim, and Ashur, Assyria. Assyria is not exactly the same as modern day Syria, but more or less the same geographical location. So the pharaoh of that time, known as Paro Necho, from Egypt, wanted to bring his soldiers through Eretz Yisrael. It was the shortest route to get to Assyria. And he wasn't at war with the Jewish people. He wanted to come through the land just with his soldiers. Yoshiyahu refused to allow it. And it was a mistake, because since he wasn't allowed to come on friendly terms, the Paro Necho simply came in on unfriendly terms. He came in with his soldiers anyways, and in the exchange, the battle that followed, Yoshiyahu himself was killed. Why did Yoshiyahu merit this terrible end? and especially describes how his body was pierced with arrows that were fired at him, hundreds of arrows. Obviously that was the means of attacking enemies in those days. So what happened here? Well, why was Yoshio at fault? Well, Yoshio was a great man, there's no doubt. And there are some who suggest that even though he perpetrated this Baal Tshuva movement, it was successful, but it wasn't as successful as he thought it was. And many people who still were Oved Avodah Zarah, at least privately, and that's why the Haftacha, which he was relying on, namely, that not only won't there any be any, you know, when things are going well for the Jewish people, we observe the mitzvahs, not only won't be at war, but no one will even pass through our land. And he thought that's we've achieved that level here. Nobody hadn't achieved it. And sadly, Yoshio, the king, ignored the advice of Yirmiyo to let them through. Yirmiyo said that we have to do this, and Yoshio didn't listen. And far be it, you know, for me to criticize the great Yoshio, but again, Chazal mentioned these points, I can say it. There was some who suggested that this terrible thing happened because despite the wonderful Baal Tshuva movement and return to Torah that Yoshio inspired, he perhaps got a little too complacent, a little too haughty, and felt that he had accomplished such an unbelievable thing. Never will HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow any punishment, anything bad to befall me. And that's a danger that sometimes, nobody can do it alone. And a person should never feel so confident in his own accomplishments that he can dismiss the advice of others. And that was the mistake that Yoshio made. He paid for it with his life. Yirmiyo, of course, was devastated and urged the people to recite a lamentation in his memory. And that's what this kin is about. But I think, again, looking for a lesson for us, that sometimes we accomplish as individuals and as a community wonderful things. And a person should undoubtedly be proud of his accomplishments, but not so proud as to think that I've achieved everything that needs to be achieved. I can now go ahead and disregard the wisdom of others who may have what to offer. Again, that was the mistake that Yoshio made. Of course, it was a shocking thing to have taken place, and perhaps in a certain sense, the end of hope for the Jewish people. A person should never feel so, the Gemara says, Al Tamen Ba'atzuch An Yom Moscha. The Gemara relates the story at a later time of the Kohen Gadol, who had been for most of his life, had served as the Kohen Gadol, one of the leading religious figures, and at the end of his life became a Tzduki, that's from the Chashmonai family. Al Tamen Ba'atzuch An Yom Moscha. You never know what can happen. Going back to what I said earlier, sometimes life changes in the blink of an eye, and many people have trouble coping with what took place. They can't believe that this happened, and a lot of their normal thoughts are changed and so on. You know, it's interesting, just an aside, that when a person wishes to convert to Judaism, to become a Ger Tzedek, and we have here in our community, there is a Beis Din for Geirus, and I'm involved in that myself. And one of the things we always speak to the Geir about right before he or she is going to go through the conversion process is that, you know, right now you're very excited about becoming Jewish, you've studied for X amount of time and made changes in your life, and really it's unbelievable sometimes to see the changes that people make. And it happens with Jews also who grew up in irreligious homes and non-observant homes and changed their whole lives. But frankly, I don't know if I would ever do it myself. I always have great respect for the people who do it. I don't know if I'd have the guts or the inner fortitude or the courage to do it myself if I wasn't brought up with it, but I respect the people who do it. But we know that sometimes these changes are motivated by whatever life experience, something which was uplifting or whatever it is. What we tell the Ger is, you recognize that, you know, sometimes we hope you have a wonderful and successful life. But, you know, it may not happen. Sometimes there are tzaras in life. You can't now turn around. Once you've converted, that's it. So we remind the convert that this is there's no turning back from this change. And want to make sure that it's not based on any preconceived notion that everything's going to be good and everything will work out. Well, we hope it is. Indeed, there's a little mishaberet, so to speak, that we recite after the conversion, wishing the person all success and all bracha in life. However, We know as adults that life's not only bracha, that things happen, there are setbacks. And Yoshio kind of fell into this trap. He, you know, everything was good, he had accomplished so much, and he did. There's no question about it. But he kind of got complacent then, you know, when something was going wrong, a possible bringing in of a foreign army into his land and so on. He did not consult the people he needed to consult and did not take advice. And when he did consult them, he paid for it very, very dearly. And so perhaps another reason why Yirmiyahu wanted us to mourn for the loss of Yoshio is not just Yoshio, the person, but what that represents, that unfortunate mistake of sometimes, you know, being so complacent, of being mamin ba'atzmecha, and thinking that nothing terrible can happen to me, everything's going to be great. It doesn't work like that. And again, that was perhaps a mistake Yoshio made, and it's a mistake some of us might be tempted to make as well. And that may be why Yirmiyahu instructed us specifically to remember the circumstances of the unfortunate death of Yoshio.
Vayikonen Yirmiyahu al Yoshio.
The next kinnah begins, Oli Asher Toavto. Here in this kinnah, every stanza ends with the word po, of course means here, and psukim that contain that that phrase. I want to focus for a moment on the word ohali, that opens every stanza. Ohel is of course a tent, and in a certain simple level, obviously, refers to the Beis Hamikdash, to the Mishkan, and so on. However, there may be another point to the use of the word Ahali instead. I mean, because, you know, one can ask, why would the author of this kinnah, was that clear, keep referring to the Beis Hamikdash as an Ohel? Well, in one sense, you could say that it's something temporary, and that's why he picks this nickname over here. But perhaps there's another reason as well, and that is that the Ohel, an Ohel represents also a person's home. And the term Mikdash, Mishkan, even Beis HaKnesses, implies a place that is very formal and it's dignified, and it is. This person is supposed to have a certain standard of behavior when entering such a place, and all that is true. However, when you're in the Ohel, oh, that's my home. My tent, this is where I live, this is not a matter of being temporary, but a matter of being more, you know, hamish, I guess, for lack of a better term. And Ohel is hamish, this is where I am, this is where I sit and have a cup of coffee, and this is where I sit and schmooze, and so on. That's the Ohel. And perhaps the idea of referring to the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, as an Ohel, is to hammer home this point as well, and that is that a person needs to feel at home when in the Beis HaMikdash, when in the Mishkan as well. It doesn't mean that there aren't certain dinim that apply in terms of the respect for the place and how to dress, and the Mishnayos tell us, you know, you're not supposed to enter with certain articles of clothing, etc. That's all true. But in terms of one's mental state, one should be at home in the Beis HaMikdash, and by extension, one should feel at home in the Beis HaKnesses and the Beis HaMedrash as well. That's our, you know, Mikdash Me'at, the Gemara tells in the end of Maseches Megillah, Eilabot Eichnes, he's about the Midrashish of Bovel, right, that the Beis HaMikdash has been replaced in our society by the Beis HaKnesses and the Beis HaMedrash. And a person is supposed to feel at home, that's the idea of the Ohel, comfortable. In fact, there are even certain dinim that a person spends time in the Beis HaMedrash, the Beis HaKnesses, is allowed to eat there, other things which ordinarily are not allowed if a person is there all the time learning, etc. I think it's important to strike that balance. Yes, a person should feel awe and reverence for the place. You have to teach your children clearly awe and reverence for the Beis HaKnesses, for the Beis HaMedrash. At the same time, you want people to feel that this is a place you know, where I can come to and feel comfortable and feel at home and feel that I'm welcome. That's part of the notion, I think, of this point as well. And each stanza, as I said, ends with the word po. Po means here, as if to say, I've made it. I've made it to the place. I'm here. I got there. Right? I've accomplished it. That's what a person should feel. When a person comes to shul, when a person comes to a Beis HaMedrash, you should feel, you know, I've made it. This is the place where I belong. This is the place where I'm comfortable. And it's interesting, so many times you see especially, forgive me, especially with older people who, Baruch Hashem, have had the opportunity to spend many years in both the Medrash and Shul. You see, when they come into the Beis Medrash, they come into the Shul, they're different people than they are out in the street. They feel a certain sense of comfort. I'm relaxed. Again, it doesn't compromise the kavod and the mor that's necessary al pi halacha in this place, but it, psychologically or internally, you feel this is a place where I belong, this is a place where I'm welcome. And the truth of the matter is, at any age, I think perhaps many of us have had this experience. If you go traveling, let's say you have to go away on business someplace, you're on vacation, you see a shul, you feel good. Right, or you find out that you're traveling over here and right now there's an inyan for mincha and you can go into the shul, you've never been there before. But the mere fact that you may never be there again, you're just passing through. But the fact that there's a shul, that there's a Beis HaMedrash there, a Jew somehow feels comfortable. You feel, oh, here I am, here I belong, this is where my, this is where I can identify. And again, I know I've had that experience. I mean, my line of work, I don't travel too much for business, but certainly, sometimes you go traveling on vacation, you come to some little town someplace, you're driving somewhere, and you find out, now you can go online and find out where there are minyanim and where there are shuls. And when you come inside, you feel good. And someone usually gives you a hello. And even if nobody does, you're in a place where you feel, this is where I belong. And I think that that's an important point about the Beis HaMikdash, and maybe that's what the Paitan was thinking here when he referred to the Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, as an OL. It's a home. It's not just a formal place that you only come to on the formal occasions. Again, we don't compromise the kavod and the dinim of Mora Mikdash and so on. Perhaps there's some Rishonim who hold that Mora Mikdash and the Beis HaKnesses, in their eyes, and the Beis HaKnesses also. But the Rain seems to hold that way. But again, without compromising that, the Beis HaMikdash, and by extension every Beis HaKnesset and Beis HaMedrash, should be viewed by a person as an OL. It's where I'm comfortable, and when I'm there, po, I'm here, I'm in a place where I belong. All the Asher Tzahav, the other issues. Increase a couple of times. The next kinnah identified the number Yud Gimel A Ko. Here again, a kina which takes psukim from the Torah, where we find the word ko used in the sense of a bracha. For example, in the first stanza of the Bris Ben Absarim, it says ko yezaracha. Later on, in the life of Moshe Rabbeinu, it says leifin ko vacho. Tis Mitzrayim ko amar Hashem kachatos halayla bechaskanim ko sevarchus bnei Yisrael. The kina then on a play on words, the word Echa says a ko. Where is the ko? Where is the avtocha of the ko? Unfortunately, it's been turned around with the Churban. But I mentioned in the past, and I mentioned again something about the word ko that the Rav Soloveitchik said, not in connection with this kina, at least not that I'm aware of, but in general, we find with regards to Akedas Yitzchak, and it's alluded to in the kina as well, that Avraham Avinu, who was accompanied not only by his son Yitzhak, obviously who was taken to the Akedah, but he was accompanied by Shnei Ne'arav Ito, the Pasuk says, and Chazal say it was Eliezer, his Eved, and Ishmael, his son from Hagar. And at one point he said to them, Shvu achem poim achamor, v'ani v'anar ne'elcha ad ko. You guys stay here, and I, the lad, young Yitzhak, how old he was, we'll go to Ad Kov. We'll go to this place where we have to go. And what's the idea? So the Medrash tells us that when they came close to the mountain, of course this is the mountain Har Moriah, right? As it says in the Pasuk, and the Har Moriah will later be the site of the Beis HaMikdash. Yet Avram saw a cloud, the Medrash says, representing the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu hovering on top of the mountain. And he asked Yitzchak, what do you see? And he said, I see something beautiful. And then he asked the other two, and they didn't see anything, they just said, I see a mountain there. And he realized that they didn't perceive what he and Yitzchak perceived, and that's why he said, okay, you'll wait here, and Yitzchak and I will go to where we have to go, and we'll come back a little later. The idea, as Salvech suggested, is that Ko represents something beyond, something more than meets the eye, something more than is, than plainly obvious. And a person to be able to see more than meets the eye has to have a certain insight. And this insight is significant in many, many different ways, in many, many different areas. A person learning, one of the things you learn when you learn Gemara is sometimes you have to read between the lines. Right? The Gemara very often doesn't spell out. Luckily we have Rashi to help us. But very often the Gemara doesn't spell out exactly what it means. And even with the Mefarshim, there are hidden meanings. Sometimes you look between the lines and see, what the Gemara didn't say. Shiurim and Tulpulim are built sometimes on what the Gemara didn't say. And why didn't it say it, right? The person with a sensitive eye, and anything, can see things if you look at things carefully. And in Lahavdil, in other works of literature or in art or even listen to music, sometimes the discerning eye, the discerning ear is able to pick up things that one doesn't always notice right away. And certainly Kamachomer will have them in the area of Torah. Well, the truth is that in terms of service of our Kadosh Baruch Hu, sometimes we have to look for more than meets the eye. Now, sometimes things seem to be a certain way, but we know that there's a Yad Hashem here, and we have to search for it. And the Beis Hamikdash, perhaps, is a place where a person saw that. Again, as I alluded to last night, people came to the Beis Hamikdash and, at least temporarily, had their questions answered. The mood that was there, the spirit that was there, the palpable Shina that was there. By the way, I didn't mention this last night, but the Gemara tells us that when you experience the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, the Beis Hamikdash, the Ruach HaKodesh, flowed and people picked it up. The Gemara mentions that Yonah, the Navi Yonah, whom we read in Yom Kippur, drew his Ruach HaKodesh from having been at the Simchas Beis HaShoeva. There was a palpable presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it was only palpable if you were in tune to notice it. If you're not in tune to notice it, so it looks like any other place. The non-discerning person will come and, won't see this. Oh, it may be a nice building, but there's nothing else to it. And again, by extension, you can take a look, I remember, sometimes when I was doing research, when I was working for Art Scroll and translating the Rishali, the stuff that I worked on. So, there's scholarship that's done in Talmud by non-Jewish scholars as well, especially German scholars and so on. It's interesting scholarship, not that we would ever determine a halacha on the basis of that, but certainly we have our own traditions, obviously, but sometimes one can see, I always wondered, what is it, why would somebody who's not Jewish or someone who's not observant bother learning Gemara and so on and so forth? And I realized that it's simply, for these people, another area of scholarship. So there's certain people who are interested in studying 14th century Chinese pottery, okay, and there are certain people interested in studying ancient Jewish writings, and that's the way they approach it. And while a person can contribute from a scholarship point of view, the person is clearly missing what we want to derive from Gemara, because the person is only seeing a very limited picture. He's not seeing it as part of a tradition, as part of a as part of a Masorah, as part of a way of life. And so we approach the study of Gemara, we're not, there's sometimes a scholarship elsewhere, but that's not the scholarship that we want to focus on when we're studying Gemara. Sometimes you can interpret a word, you can find the words that the people understood, and you can understand that. The Gemara itself has that. The Gemara itself in Megillah speaks about Amsa the Beirabi, that sometimes the Chachamim didn't know the meaning of a word, so they heard presumably a non-Jewish servant in the house of Rebbe used that word in a certain context, they understood what the Pasuk meant. That's a Gemara Megillah. There's a couple of examples of cases where the Chachamim were unsure as to the meaning of a word in a Pasuk, and for that they were able to hear how somebody... But in terms of understanding the meaning of a Pasuk, in terms of understanding the meaning of a Gemara, that has to be from our own tradition, from our own Masorah, because a person can be a scholar, a person can know vocabulary, and yes, you can learn something, from such a person too, but in terms of getting the inner meaning, what Gemara really is, and what Psukim really are, that's not going to come from Amsa the Beirabi, it's not going to come from any German scholar, because they're missing a certain piece to it. They're missing the ko, that which is beyond. We're going to go beyond what's in the, what's immediately noticeable. Of course, in this kina, the question is, hey, ko, what happened? How did it all go wrong? That's the kina. But I think this lesson is also valuable, that a person has to, when approaching Torah, when approaching learning, and when approaching Avodas Hashem, you have to look beyond what's immediately accessible, what's immediately visible to the eye, and strive to reach ko. Try to go beyond into the next level. And Again, I guess, although this kina presents it in a negative sense, the lesson to take home, I believe, or at least one of the lessons to take home, is this idea that a person who's steeped in tradition, steeped in our Masorah, steeped in the Chazal and so on, can see much more in terms of Avodas Hashem, in terms of Talmud Torah, than what's immediately visible at first glance. The next kina 14, Eicha es asher kar asuhu, means very simple, looking at the first phrase, it has already been done. Eicha es asher kar asuhu. Everything has already been determined, everything's already done. The Medrash says at the time of Brias Olam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu already foresaw the Beis HaMikdash rebuilt and destroyed and then rebuilt. And that's based on a psukim. The Medrash mentions the Brashas Bor Elokim. That's an allusion to the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Artas Sohu Vavo hints at its destruction. And Bar Malakim Yihor, that's the rebuilding. Now, the other parts of the Kinnah deal with the fact that while they knew the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed, the date of its rebuilding remains a mystery, and we still don't know, obviously, when it's going to be rebuilt. But the question is that, why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu ordain that already? From the very beginning of creation, that the Beis HaMikdash would have to be destroyed. I want to go into now the issue of free will versus divine foreknowledge, that the paradox, the philosophical paradox, important though it is, but why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu set things up that way? And the answer may be that it's precisely in order to prevent people from thinking that they have all the answers and that you're in control such that nothing can possibly change. And that's the theme I think we've developed a little bit this morning, that things can change, terrifying. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in one of his drushes that many people think that they're completely in charge of their lives and their futures, and people think if you have some money in the bank, then you're set, right? You're set, and your children are set. And what could possibly go wrong? What's interesting, Rav Moshe wrote this drush in 1922, a couple years before the Great Depression. But obviously people's life savings kind of disappeared just like that. Speak about the current financial crisis. So no one would believe the United States would have its credit rating lowered and so on and so forth, as we saw just happen. And there is a certain sense that Golas reminds us that a person can never become complacent. We're not completely in charge. Somebody else is in charge. And obviously, that doesn't mean that a person abdicates his responsibility to do what he has to do, and to make every possible plan for a successful future and the future of his children. Of course, you do that. But at the end of the day, it's Yisrael B'tach Hashem. It's not going to be up to the person to determine whether his ventures are going to be successful. A person has to put in his best effort. A person has to do the best that he can. But ultimately, he has to know that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eicha es asher kar asu means it already happened. And in the afternoon, at Mincha time, we're going to read the Pasuk in the Haftarah, Ki lo machshav osai machshav oseichem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's thinking isn't the same as my thinking, your thinking. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees everything at once. We can't do that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is aware at once what the past, present, and future. A person is unable to understand that. And therefore, the notion of Golas being something that was determined already at the time of Bereishis, according to the Medrash, it means it was built into the world. That's what I think the Medrash is trying to say. It's built into the nature. It's built into the world that this is the way things are, that things aren't always obvious and things don't always work out exactly as planned. Again, doesn't mean that a person doesn't make every plan. But to say that I can rely because I've taken precautions or I've done X, Y, and Z, that means everything's going to work out exactly as I hope and plan. That's not true, and that's exactly what the whole Megillah Seichot teaches us in a certain way. In fact, it's interesting to note that historically, about 150 or so years before, or less, before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, was the destruction of the northern tribes. We know that after the death of Shlomo HaMelech, the Jewish nation split into two, the so-called northern kingdom, Malchus Yisrael, the southern kingdom, Malchus Yehuda. They had different kings throughout all of Sefer Melachim, those who study remember. The Malchus Yisrael fell fell at the hands of Sanherib, an Assyrian general, and he did not stop after conquering the northern kingdom. He moved on to the southern kingdom also to try and conquer Yerushalayim, but he was unsuccessful in that attempt. He was unsuccessful in that bid, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu spared Yerushalayim at that time. However, it had the exact opposite effect as that one was desired, HaKadosh Baruch Hu desired, because it, instead of inspiring people to do tshuva, because it was a close call, instead people's response was, well, Hashem will never destroy Yerushalayim. Right? That's the worst state here. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is a safe house. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not going to destroy Yerushalayim. Look, even Sanherib couldn't destroy it. Others that came were unable to destroy Yerushalayim. Of course, Echas Asher Kvar Asu was determined that Yerushalayim would fall as well. A person can never be so complacent or never be so sure of himself as to think that that everything is well and it doesn't matter anything now what I do. That's not the case. Even after a person has taken whatever precautions he has to for his future, still has to be misfollowed by Kadosh Baruch Hu for his assistance, and only then can you be assured of some measure of success. Next, Kina starts at Echa Ashposo Pasuch Kekever. This is the longest of the Kinos because it's modeled, it's the longest of the Kinos because it's modeled after the third parak in Megillas Echa, which has three psukim for each letter of the Aleph Beis. And there's 66 psukim. As we know, the first parak, the second parak, and the fourth parak of Megillas Echa follows the Aleph Beis pattern. Each parak has one pasuk per letter of the Aleph Beis. The third parak has three psukim per letter of the Aleph Beis. And this kina contains references to each of those three. It also contains a reference to each of the three prokim and the fifth parak, which has 22 psukim, although not having as many Aleph Beis pattern. So therefore it's a complicated, intricate kina, but I say its length is based on the fact that it follows this pattern. But what's stuck in this kina as well is psukim from Parshas V'Hukosai, again from the Tochacha. So every stanza ends with a reference from the Tochacha and Parshas V'Hukosai, and again, the idea is that the Torah itself is already foretold that all these tragedies would eventually take place. Now, the Ramban, in his commentary to the Chumash, notes that these tragedies have in fact taken place. It's not just the Benavuah, but these tragedies did take place, and many of the things which the Torah describes, even the most terrible things, historically have happened in the history of the Jewish people. Just to focus on something, again, the opening phrase, it says, Echa Ashposo Pasuch Kekever. Ashpo means like a quiver, like where you have arrows, and Kadosh Baruch Hu opened it up, so to speak, to fire what he had to fire, just double barrel, we would say in English, both barrels expended, or both barrels smoking. Kadosh Baruch Hu threw everything at Klal Yisrael. And again, the notion is that here we consider ourselves to have this relationship with our Kadosh Baruch Hu, which is unique, which is special, and somehow things went so sour that he threw the whole kitchen sink at us in destroying the Beis HaMikdash and taking us to exile and leaving us in exile for such an extended period of time. However, what's significant is, again, the Tochacha, as Psukim are alluded to here or quoted here in the end of each stanza, tells us the result of all of this, the cause for all this. And the cause for all of it is that in Lo Sishma Uli, we didn't listen to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. And therefore the implication is that the way to undo, the way to change what has happened is by doing tshuva. And the truth of the matter is, Rav Soloveitchik and others have developed this, tshuva is a hidden theme of Tisha B'Av as well. We tend to focus primarily on Avelos, right, on the laws of mourning. But Tisha B'Av at the same time is a Tainus Tzibur. And Tisha B'Av is sort of a fusion of those two different kinds of days. It's a day of Avelos, and it's a day of Tshuva. Actually, Rav Soloveitchik on a different occasion developed that the whole concept of sitting Shiva, Rachmana Litzlan, is also a form of Tshuva. That's not for right now. But in terms of Tisha B'Av, Tisha B'Av is sort of a fusion of a day of mourning and sadness with a day of Tshuva, because that's what can undo it. And we see that actually in the Kriyas HaTorah that we laid this morning at Shacharis. The Tshuva is a theme of Vikashta Mishonah Hashem Elokecha Motoso Kisa Yishenu B'chol Avochav V'chol Nafshecha. If we search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we can find him. So perhaps this, you know, this very, very long kinah, but this kinah which highlights, aside from the psukim in Megillas Eicha, which highlights phrases from Parshas B'Chukosai, tells us that there is a solution, and the solution is tshuva. At the same time, it's noteworthy that in Parshas B'Chukosai itself, there's a hidden sort of silver lining, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, ultimately, Zachartim HaBris Rishon, actually that pasuk is in the kinah as well. HaKadosh Baruch Hu remember the bris, and even without tshuva, there will come a time where HaKadosh Baruch Hu will return to us anyway. If we do tshuva, if we're zoches, it'll happen more quickly, but even if it doesn't, there is a time that the sort of the silver lining in the tocha of the chukosai, there's a haftacha, there's a promise of Zachartim HaBris Rishon, Zachartim HaBris Yaakov, etc., those psukim. It's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu will eventually remember. Now, we have a contradiction in Novi. There are psukim which seem to say that, Mashiach is going to come in a quick, hastened fashion. It says, Achishena, it's one of the psukim in the Haftarahs of the Shevet and the Chemta in the weeks after Tisha B'Av. But it also says in the same phrase, Be'ito, Be'ito Achishena. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, we'll bring about the Gula, Be'ito, and it's time, Achishena, I will hasten it. So how can that be? If you're hastening it, that doesn't mean it's not the right time. If it's the right time, it means you didn't hasten it. So the Gemara says, it depends whether we deserve it. Zochu achishena, lo zochu vito. If we're meritorious and we deserve it, so then it'll be achishena, because we're going to hasten it. How do we deserve it? We deserve it to tshuva. However, if not, it'll still come to ito. So perhaps there is this, in this long kinah, there is this silver lining that eventually there'll be an opportunity for us to return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, preferably through tshuva, but even if not, the Zacharti is brisi, and you'll see towards the end, the theme of tshuva is there, at the very end of the kinah, the Hashiveinu v'Hareinu elachukim, bring us back to observe the mitzvahs, because that will undo everything in a more timely fashion. Then we have to wait for the Be'ita, which, as discussed in the previous kinah, we don't really know what it is. The next kinah begins Chora She'osa Tzar Bifinim, and is the story of the Roman general Titus, who destroyed the second Beis Hamikdash. He succeeded his father Vespasian, who began the siege in Yerushalayim, but then was called back to become the emperor. And Titus was the one who ultimately destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. And the kinah basically sort of contrasts the notion that Titus was able to go into the Beis Hamikdash and do what he wanted there, when we know la halacha, someone who's not a kohen is not permitted to go into the Beis Hamikdash at all. And even someone who's a kohen, like Nadav and Avihu, are permitted to do only certain things, and when they did other things in the Beis Hamikdash, they were struck down immediately, and yet nothing happened to Titus when he now went into the Beis Hamikdash, into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But actually it says Zezona Tzoa Hichnis, he brought a Zona with him into the Beis Hamikdash, and nothing ever happened to him. How could such a thing be? It's almost as though Vehu Asur Bazikin, says later, the Zohar Kodesh Baruch Hu was chained up Kaviyachlan was not able to help. He was like trapped. He couldn't do anything about it. And so that's what the kinnah talks about. Just call your attention towards the end of the kinnah, the phrase Al Tzad Maravi Lezecher Hisrid Bo, that there was something left of that Beis Hamikdash on the western side, for reference to the Kosel Hamaravi. But anyway, the point being that Titus seems to have been victorious. However, we can ask the question, was Titus ultimately victorious? The story regarding the Panavizhirov. And the Panavizhirov once went to Italy to raise funds for the Panavizhir Yeshiva. And he called Moshe Rothschild, who was a wealthy, from the Rothschild family, wealthy Jew, then living in Rome, and wanted to meet him. And certainly Rothschild was honored to meet with the Panavizhirov. And as soon as Moshe Rothschild came to see him, it was late at night, the Panavizhirov asked to be brought to the Arch of Titus. The Romans, we know, were terribly proud of their conquest of Eretz Yisrael. In fact, they minted a special coin. You can see it in museums in Eretz Yisrael today. The minted special coin, which on one side of the coin had Vespasian's face with a victory wreath on his head. The other side has a Jew sitting forlorn, and the words Judea Capta, Judea has fallen, has been captured, engraved onto the stone, onto the coin rather. Anyway, then we know about the Arch of Titus in Rome, and the Panavizhirov wanted right then to go to the Arch of Titus. And, obviously it was important, but why would the Panavizhirov want to go there at that late hour at night and so on? But he took him anyway, and it was happily pouring rain, and when they left, they got there, the rain had just stopped. And according to the record of the story which I have here, it said the Panavizhirov stepped out of the car, straightened his hat and coat, and he screamed and he says, "Titus, Titus, Mir Zen and Dov, who's Zent here? Okay, we're here now. Where are you? You captured the Beis Hamikdash, you destroyed it, you murdered us and slaughtered our children, you imprisoned our families and stole our holy vessels, but we have risen from that destruction. Countless yeshivas have been built. Look at the royalty of Torah that we have today. But you, Titus, what remains of you? What remains of your empire? Absolutely nothing. Who remembers you? No one. All you have is an arch. That's all that remains from your life. And beyond that, nothing." And the idea is that even though at the time Titus was victorious, and we lament that victory in this particular kinnah, nonetheless, ultimately, the mere fact that we are recounting what happened when most people in the Roman, in the Western civilization, have barely ever heard of Titus, and maybe they've heard of the Arch of Titus, but that's about it. It's a very, very different picture. And the mere fact that we do remember, as I mentioned last night, that's what Chazal mean when they say, "Kol Mitzavah L'Yerushalayim." As long as there are people in Mitzavah L'Yerushalayim, that itself is a nechama. That itself means that we're going to see the nechama, because it's so much, very much part of our lives. I'll just repeat here a story that I've told in past years, I'm fond of, because one of the protagonists in the story was a rabbi of mine who told me, told our class once, that when he was in graduate school, he was taking summer courses in Columbia University here in New York, and you had a graduate class of 40, 50 students, and there were two or three other yeshiva boys were in this course, and during the 9 days and 3 weeks, they came to class unshaven. Obviously, in the minimum of 3 weeks, the 9 days, and the professor, who was not Jewish, at one point on one certain day, it was during the 3 weeks, he asked the class, "Does anybody know what today marks on our calendar?" Nobody knew, and he informed the class that this was a day on which the Roman Empire fell. The Roman Empire didn't fall in one day; it was a process, but if one of the official ends of the Roman Empire was on that date, so many centuries earlier. And this non-Jewish professor said, "You know, it's interesting. We're from Western civilization, and so much of Western civilization and Western culture is based on Rome, the Roman Empire. And we don't even know what day the Roman Empire fell. None of us even care. It's not part of our lives. It's not something we even think about. Even though our very culture, and certainly for Christians, the spread of Christianity was due to their influence in the Roman Empire, we're not interested in this. It's not part of our lives. But he said that there are, you look in the back of the room, you see a couple of fellows here who come to class in the last few weeks without shaving. The reason they're not shaving is because they're mourning the destruction of their temple in Jerusalem. And to them, they know very well the date on which their temple was destroyed. They know very well the date on which their empire, so to speak, their country fell, and their culture was changed and so on for the worse. They remember it. They still live it. And that's because they remain connected to it. That's a sign that one day, this is a non-Jewish professor, said it's a sign that one day they'll return to their land. Their culture will still survive. So that's like what the Panevizhi wrote, said over here, what's left of Titus? There's a monument, there's an arch, but nothing else. But for us, this is very much alive. We're still here, and what he destroyed, we've rebuilt, and we continue to survive even after this kind of tragedy. Zohar shows, so it's obviously the next kino in Tochanan Noshim is a very, very graphic kino describing the horror of the experience of the siege of Yerushalayim and what had to be done for people to survive. Take a look in your kinos as you read through it. Really very very horrible description of things, beginning with the reference of the pasuk in Megillas Eichon, Perek Beis, that women had to eat the flesh of their own children. I can't even imagine such a thing as ever happening, or cook the children. People who were merciful, good people, had sunk to such a terrible level. They were robbed of any kind of humanity. It's interesting that I think we've made this analogy in the past. People are mistreated and people suffer, so sometimes they lose any sense of the human dignity. That was part of the plan that the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, carried out at the time of the Holocaust, was to dehumanize the Jewish people. You see pictures of Jews in the camps, the liberation or whatever. One thing at least that always struck me is that it was hard to tell people apart. Everyone looked the same. They're wearing the same striped uniform, and hair is very closely shaven, and so on. Any individuality or human dignity was taken away. That was done by Chavana. But what I'm focused on in this akina, again, with such a graphic description, is the refrain that comes up, Alalai Li, woe unto me, or alas unto me. That's just like almost like a cry, a primordial cry. You know, there's nothing to even say. When you read these things, sometimes you can't even find the right words to describe suffering. And that's the idea of crying. A person cries out, it's just like a shriek or a yelp. You can't help it. And there's no words. Words don't sufficiently describe that feeling. I spoke earlier about the importance of, or the greatness of man being that man has the capacity to speak and to verbalize, and it's true most of the time. But sometimes there are events or there are things that are just so horrible you can't even put words to it. And all you can say is something like, Alalai Li, just woe unto me. It's a cry, it's a shriek. And that's what happened here. Even man's ability to speak and to verbalize was taken away. Again, as we mentioned at the beginning, kinos has that cathartic capacity when you speak something out, when you talk about things, so it's healthy. But the truth is that sometimes crying and wailing and just the shrieking is also healthy. Again, depending upon the circumstances, depending upon the appropriateness of it at a given time. But that's what this kinah does. If these things happen, each stanza begins with im. If such a thing could happen, what can I say but Alalai Li, woe unto me. The horrible, I can just cry. I can't justify it, can't explain it, can't articulate it. Right? It's just Alalai Li. That's the theme of this kinah. Just call your attention to the fact that at the very end of the kinah, there is a reference to the killing of the Navi, the Kohen Zechariah. But that's something which, although it appears at the end of this kinah, we'll talk when we get to this kinah about that particularly. So we'll get to it there. Here we'll just focus on the Alalai Li, the crying, which is just something which is beyond expression of what's beyond what a person is able to tolerate. the next kin of Ator Marta, he Tayyidik Sidimach, again draws the contrast between what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did for us initially and what ended up happening. Ator, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did wonderful things, Olama, so how come now, terrible things, etc. There is a statement in the later in the kinah, it says, Olama Yozmu Mo'avim V'amonim La'am Zo B'Kruvim Monim. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by the Babylonians, and the Medrash tells us in Eicha that the Babylonians, when they came into the Beis HaMikdash, they wanted to loot the gold and the silver and plunder the place to take the spoils. However, the Ammonian Moabim went in for the purpose of mocking the Jewish people and mocking the Torah. And the Medrash tells them they took the Kruvim, that's what's referred to in this line, Moabim Ammonim La'amzu B'Kruvim Monim. They took the Kruvim, which were on top of the Aron, and they paraded it around Jerusalem and made fun of the Jews and said, look what we found in their holiest place in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. They worship idols too. The Kruvim, of course, were the winged creatures that are built into the top of the Aron, as mandated by the Pasuk and the Chumash. And the Hamonim and Moabim, according to this Medrash, which is referred to in this Kinnah, have made fun of the Jewish people in this regard, saying, you're like everybody else. Just, it's a little bit a point to learn from, that, if we end up behaving like everyone else in our shuls, in our Batei Medrash, so that's something that the Goyim will mock. We want to hold ourselves to a higher level of behavior. Many times, and this is brought down by the Poskim, that an embarrassment, a source of embarrassment for the Jewish people, that people come to shul, the shuls are noisy, that people talk in shul, and some of the Poskim note that even in the non-Jewish houses of worship, they're quiet, they're more respectful, and I don't know if that's true or it's not true, or maybe it once was true, I'm not sure it still is true, but at least that in theory, or at least at one time, it was known that you walked into a non-Jewish house of worship, so there was a great respect, and it was a quiet, and so on, a great dignity, which unfortunately at times is lacking in the Jewish shuls. And that's a source of embarrassment for us, just as what Ammon and Moab did here. So perhaps, we can take a lesson and see to it. Again, we have to strike that balance, as I discussed earlier. Shul has to be a place where people feel comfortable, where people feel at home, but it cannot be compromising the dignity of the place, the halachas of covering for the place, the halachas of proper davening and not talking, and so on and so forth, because if we do that, then we're embarrassed because we have even a lower level of respect, at least an apparently lower level of respect for our Batei Medrash and our Batei Knesios than the non-Jews have for their houses of worship. And in fact, one of the Poskim notes that we in this regard should learn from the non-Jews. They know how to behave in their houses of worship, and we should learn from them. I'm not saying that that everything's necessarily perfect there either. I don't know the facts well enough about that. But the truth of the matter is, it's a place of dignity. It has to be a place of dignity for us as well. And the Ammonim and Moabim did not hesitate to make fun when they thought that we were no better and no different than they are. As mentioned, it's kind of Tom Arzo. Now the next kina, which really is a continuation of what we just read, comes the Cho Hashem Atzdoka V'lono Boshes Haponim. In the previous kina, it was a question, right? Atah Marta and Lama. Now we come to the answer that really this is a fault. We deserve it. It's a form of vidui, if you will. I spoke before about the importance of tshuva in the kina's process, in the Tisha B'Av process. And here is the response. L'cho Hashem Atzdoka, we recognize that in fact we deserve whatever has come upon us. But it's interesting that it's divided into two different kinnas, and I think that may be because sometimes you can ask the question. A moment of anger, a moment of great depression, it's okay to ask the question, and it's okay for a person not to have the answer. The answer is not given until this kinna. Actually alluded to the very end of the previous kinna. The questions of Lama, Lama, Lama are good questions. And sometimes a person needs, again, in line with what we've been discussing all morning, to be able to vent a little bit, to be able to express the torture or the sadness that he feels internally, And you can ask the question. And sometimes it's okay to ask the question. You don't always have to have an answer. Sometimes, you know, we're trained sometimes that we always have to try and find an answer, look for a carrot. Sometimes the kasha is a good kasha, you can leave it at that. Maybe later will be an appropriate time for an answer. When somebody comes, you know, broken-hearted or depressed or sad about whatever has happened, and the person starts asking why, you don't give them an answer. Not looking for a rational approach at that particular moment. The person rather is just looking to be able to express and to vent a little bit and to be upset, and he doesn't want a logical answer. Sometimes we make that mistake. I know sometimes people point it out that the people who study about or write about relationships between husbands and wives, sometimes the men tend to be very rational and logical, and women often tend to be more emotional. Sometimes the woman wants to be able to vent something, so she presents the problem to her husband. And her husband says, well, let me explain here how you can do it. That's not the right approach. She's not looking for the answer. She can figure it out herself. She's also intelligent. She just wants to vent, and the husband doesn't understand. He says, what do you mean? What did I do wrong? I'm not supporting you. I told her how to solve the problem. It's not interesting hearing how to solve the problem just then. She also knows how to solve it. She just wants sometimes to vent. Well, that's why perhaps here too we have two different kinnas. One is the question, lama, lama, no answer in that kinna. Then, later on, you have time to reflect, you vent a little bit, you've expressed your question, has been taken seriously, the person accepts it, you know, it's a good question. Now we're ready for the answer, the first time I talk. I think that's also part of the cathartic process, if you will, of reciting kinnas. We can ask Eicha, and how could such a thing happen, and why did Hashem do this, and how could you treat us this way? All these are good questions, and sometimes you let people vent, and you let people phrase the question, and complain, and express their sadness. That's what kinnas are about. And later, now we're deeper into the kinnas, so now you can sit back a little bit and perhaps propose some answers, and that's what this kinnah does. If we're chash Hashem atzlach, we recognize that in fact we're deserving, and as I said before, if we want to want to turn things around, so that's our own particular responsibility. And having now said, Lanubos Lachosh Anastok and Lanubosh is upon him. So the next kinnah, which I guess is the conclusion of this section, that now we can ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hatel HaKayaz Nechal Shema. Now that we've sort of acknowledged our role and that we've not done everything proper, so the completion of the tshuva, so to speak, is to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to turn his ear, so to speak, and to hear the cry and to give us what we want. Towards the very end of the kinnah, it says, "Ushma b'chias maspidim v'torim v'chakim mosa yibaneh." Listen to the weeping of those who eulogize and those who talk, as we discuss in v'chakim. We wait mosa yibaneh. Yes, mosa yibaneh. In other words, we're saying, as part of the tshuva process, we recognize our errors, we recognize our mistakes, we've done the vidui, so to speak, and now we have this. Therefore, we request our Kadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, we're not blaming you, so to speak. We raised our issues, we poured out our hearts, we acknowledge our role, and therefore we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Chor Ponecha Mitzosh Vashomim, to turn and to listen to our, to accept our tefillos. Hatei Elohim. The next kina, Arzi Alavana Nadirei Torah, is of course one of the most famous kinos, the kina of the Asara Harug Yamalkos. Actually, in this particular kinnah, only eight are mentioned. Mentions, of course, on Yom Kippur as well. And the theme here, of course, is the theme of martyrdom. And with all that, it's part of the puzzle that we don't understand, and we can't really have a good answer to as to why HaKadosh Baruch Hu would ever allow such a thing to take place. I saw somewhere that the I don't remember whose interpretation it was, my Chassidish interpretation, that you know when we recite Shema, which is the traditional tefillah of someone who's been taken to martyrdom, we have stories in the Holocaust about it, and we cover our eyes. So it's questionable exactly where that comes from. Where does that meaning, that practice, when we say Shema Yisrael, Shema Lekenesh, Shema Echad? Where does that come from? It's really not clear at all. Certainly not mentioned in the Mishnah or in the Gemara as an obligation. There is one a reference in the Gemara that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi would give a shir and Zman Kriyashma came, so he, you know, would be in the middle of a shir, so he turned away and he covered his eyes, and that was Mekabal Malchus Shamayim that way, but that's about it in terms of the Gemara, at least to the best of my knowledge, in terms of any kind of reference to that. So those suggest that it's simply a means of cutting ourselves off from the rest of the world, some say for concentration, for kavana, fine. But more than that, it's also to indicate that there are simply things that we can't understand. And therefore it mentions in this kina that when the kiva was taken away, it's one of the, obviously one of the Asura Gamathus was the great kiva, and it says that the kiva was taken away, and he was saying Shema at that time. He also said Shmoso be'echod, and his soul departed and came to the word Echod. Does that mean necessarily that he was taken out by the middle of Shacharis or Zvan Kriyashma? Probably not. Probably it means that he said this Shema because that is, you know, with his eyes closed perhaps or covered, as a symbol that there is nothing that we understand, that there's no reason for this that we can relate to. Doesn't mean, however, that a Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't relate to it, doesn't have a reason for it. A Kadosh Baruch Hu has a reason. It's interesting that the presentation of the kina as it appears in the Yom Kippur version of it, which is a different version. The presentation of Yom Kippur is different than this one. In the Yom Kippur version, it says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu threatened when the Malachim began to complain and said, Zutorah, Zutorah, is this the reward for those who study Torah? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you better be quiet, I'm going to turn the whole world back into Mayan, into water. Again, that doesn't appear, at least not directly in this kina, but it appears in the Yom Kippur version of it. What's the idea? Because Baruch Hu said, I'll destroy the world. Why is that the appropriate response to that question? The question was Zutara, was Zuskara? Is this the reward for those who study Torah? How can it be? And he answered, I'm going to destroy the world. So Rav Shlomo Kluger explained, it's not a matter of destroying the world as a punishment. But the only way you'll understand how this fits in is if I go back and start the world over again, you can understand and see everything that has happened till now. It's part of a pattern, it's part of a plan. Shlomo Kluger gives a mushel to a king who has his favorite tailor, and he comes across, this king does some very expensive fabric someplace, and he's out overseas. When he comes back with his expensive fabric, he asks the tailor to make him a suit or whatever it is out of this fabric, and the tailor does so, and it's very beautiful, but somehow rumors begin to circulate that, you know, the suit is smaller than that amount of fabric should have yielded. And therefore, the suggestion was that maybe the tailor put aside some of this fabric for himself, you know, on the side. He made the king the uniform and the suit that he requested, but then he put aside some of the fabric for himself. And he swore up and down that he didn't do it. And he said, the only way he can prove it is if he takes the entire suit apart, takes it out piece by piece, then you'll see that every bit of fabric that was given was used. Then you can understand it. That's Shlomo Kluger's metaphor, his mushel. And he says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told the Malachim that you want to understand what's happening here with the Asura Gemalchus and with martyrs in general, because we know, historically speaking, that the Asura Gemalchus didn't all live at the same exact time. It's not accurate that they were all massacred together in one shot or one room and so on, despite the dramatic presentation in the Yom Kippur version of the Kina. But the idea is we can't understand it. Not everything is explicable, and the only way sometimes we can understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan is if we'd be able to see everything from the moment the world was created, and we can't do that. And sometimes you just have to accept, and we weep over it, and it's a terrible thing, there's no doubt, but nonetheless, we can't really offer a good explanation. There isn't always an answer. Like I mentioned earlier, not every question has an answer that we're capable of understanding. The next kina begins Hachrishu Mimeni Vadabera. It's a very interesting kina because, first of all, it's not clear who the author is. And perhaps more significantly, it's also not even clear what event or which particular massacre or tragedy it is referring to. The reason that's interesting is that it's a sad commentary because it could refer, sadly, to any number of different tragedies In other words, we've undergone as a people so many different slaughters and so many different pogroms and so many different tragedies in the millennia of our history, that this kinnah could fit very many different ones. The descriptions herein also somewhat graphic about parents having to slaughter their own children rather than watch them be tortured by the enemy. The concept of kiddush shem shamayim and so on. And the refrain, Ori v'sichi v'ohima v'kol mihi orima, I will lament as I speak and moan, I'll simply raise the sound of a kina, of a lament. You know, you see the anguish, so to speak, of the person who, I guess, was an eyewitness to the whatever tragedy this kina focuses on. And again, the mere fact that we don't know which one it is, and it could be anyone, is a very tragic commentary on our history. Just call your attention to one phrase. It says, "Swal tamur ha'agdu b'chavura." There's such a concept called avelus b'ramei. Agdu b'chavura means get together in a group, make a chavura to weep and to mourn and to eulogize and any particular tragedy is referring to. But there is enough notion of being this abel together. Avelus b'yachid, of course, is when there's a person suffers a personal loss in the family. That's tragic. But there's also avelus derabim when the community, but there's another idea, a community suffers a loss, like the avelus of the churban. However, there's something else also, and that is when there's avelus derabim, one gets a sense that people together can bring each other out of the avelus. When there are people who are observing mourning something together, so again, there's a hidden, I don't want to say a hidden bracha exactly, but I do want to say some sort of silver lining again, as it were, because the fact that there are other people who are part of this tragedy as well gives me some sort of a nechama that other people, not because we're happy that someone else is suffering, but other people can relate to my suffering. The most difficult thing is, I think, for many people, is when something upsets you and nobody else seems to understand why you're upset about it. And I'm going to tell you, oh, don't worry about it, it's not a big deal. In fact, sometimes people say the wrong things, in my opinion, when they come to a Beis Avel sometimes. You have to know how to view the Beis Avel. I actually saw an article about this in a magazine recently, a Jewish magazine. And sometimes people, meaning well, of course, 100%, they mean well, but you say just the wrong things when you come to visit somebody in a Beis Avel. You know, you don't want to tell a person, oh, it'll be all right. That's not what they want to hear right now. Don't worry, everything's going to be fine. Everything's fine. No, it's not for them right now. It's not fine for them. It's not good right now. Now, how are you? Oh, I'm doing great. You know, you have to be sensitive, and it's very, very discomforting, I think, for a person to be upset about anything and to feel that nobody else feels their pain. Nobody else understands why you're so upset. Everyone else says, well, it's not a big deal. Well, to me, it is a big deal. I am hurt by this. I'm upset by this. And other people telling me, you know, it's not worth making such a fuss over, or it's not worth being that sad about it. That's not helpful. And therefore, when you have, it may be helpful further down the road, but initially, when a person's suffering, it's the wrong thing to say. And therefore, in this kinnah, it says, He'agdu b'chavura, if you get together in a group, and everybody's feeling the same pain, that itself relieves me in the sense that I know there are people who understand where I'm coming from here. There are people who are sensitive and who experience the same loss. And I'm not going to be on top of my suffering, and I have to sort of feel that everyone thinks I'm crazy or no one else really sees the significance of this as I do. When people get together with a group and mourn together, the collective mourning brings a certain amount of nechama in that regard by itself. The next kinnah ves Novi Chatzosi Shmimo is the famous story of the children of Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, who were taken into slavery, separated from each other, and unbeknownst to each other, ended up being sold to Romans who lived next door to each other. And each one of them, both the son and the daughter, were very attractive looking, very beautiful looking. And the two captors decided that it would be a good idea to mate this young man and young woman, and they would have beautiful children, and so on. And the son of Rishon, Kohen Gadol, wept all night long, and son and daughter, when they realized what was going to happen, again, each one not knowing who the other person was. And when they were in the room together, they They look at each other, they both cried in their corner, and eventually, in effect, they cried themselves to death. And that's how they died. And we have the refrain of Arbisi Vahim Rakol Nahi Arima, Vahima Miyamim Yamima, again, will wail and cry, for all the days. And so the emphasis in this kina is on tears, is on weeping. And of course, that's a theme of Tisha B'Av as well. We've spoken about that at greater length in past years, of the concept of Bechia, of Bacho Sivka, of crying, of weeping. They say that Shmuel Shofar Hirsch once said that tears are the sweat of the neshama, the sweat of the soul. And I think, again, if we appreciate the Amir of Kinnis, as I've been describing all morning, as a way to free the neshama, so to speak, or to have the neshama express itself, so part of that as well is for tears. But you have to know that tears have to appear at the right time as well, because the Gemara tells us in the end of Maseches Tainis that part of the reason for Tisha B'Av is because people wept at an inappropriate time. It says in the Torah regarding the Meraglim that after their negative report concerning Eretz Yisrael, it says Vayivku Am B'Laila Ahu, they cried that night, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu determined Matem B'Chisem B'Chiyah Shochinam, that night you cried for no reason, this night's going to be a night of crying for all time, for a real reason. And so a person has to be careful. It's okay to cry, but you have to make sure to you know what you're crying for. Medrash says, I believe it's a Medrash in Tillim, says that had the Jewish people cried a little bit before the Chorban, it wouldn't have happened. It was only afterwards. It says, Al Naros Bobel, Shom Yoshavnu Gam Bochinu. Tillim, Parakuf Lamed Zayin, right? Al Naros Bobel, we came to the waters of Bobel, the rivers of Bobel, then Shom Yoshavnu Gam Bochinu, then we sat and we wept. But they didn't weep beforehand. So again, weeping in a certain sense is an art as well. You have to know how to use, you have to know to weep at the right time. But Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar wept at the wrong time, and it ended up spelling tragedy. And in the days of the Churban Bayis Rishon, they failed to weep at the proper time. They wept only on Aros Bavel, and therefore the Beis Hamikdash perhaps might not have been destroyed, but it was destroyed. And so, when we sit on Tisha B'Av and weep and read Bachosiv Kebalaila, it's to be in the proper time, in the proper atmosphere, and that's exactly the weeping of the son and daughter of Rabbi Shmuel Chon Gadol, described in this kina. This Novi Chatos Yishmimo. The next kina, Al Churban Beis Hamikdash Kihuras V'Chihudash, is a description of, or sort of summary of different aspects of the Korban, and we find in this particular kina a reference to the beautiful clay hamikdash, the different vessels which were used in the Beis Hamikdash, and the furnishings which were also looted and then taken away at that time. I'll just call your attention to one pasuk, the one phrase at the beginning. It says, Espo b'chol shana v'shana mispeid chadash. You have to have a new eulogy every single year. What do you mean new? We've been doing this for many, many years, for many, many centuries. What's the idea of a mispeid chadash? It has to be a new eulogy? What's new about it? And I think the answer is, because the Gemara tells us, chol dor shol nidne beis hamikdash b'yamav k'lu nechor b'yamav. Any Beis Hamikdash, any door which did not witness the building of the Beis Hamikdash is as if the Beis Hamikdash were destroyed. So yes, it's in a certain sense the Beis Hamikdash is destroyed anew every single year. And in that sense there's a parallel to the Leil Pesach, when the Mishnah tells us that a person has to consider himself on Pesach Kilu Yotzei Mitzrayim, as though I personally just came out of Mitzrayim. That's one of the mitzvahs of Leil Pesach, which is obviously part of the Haggadah as well, the Mishnah in the end of in the 10th parak of Pesachim. So too, in a certain sense, on Tisha B'Av, it's Espod B'chol Shana B'Shana Mispeid Chadash, that Beis Hamikdash was just destroyed this year. How that? Because it wasn't rebuilt. If it wasn't rebuilt, it's as if it was destroyed, and therefore we have this obligation each year to renew our recitation of kinnas and to deliberate misbeit chodosh, because the Beis HaMikdash has still not yet been rebuilt. The next kinnah mitain Rosh Yimayim is a kinnah relating not to the Churban Beis HaMikdash but to the period of the Crusades, and the dates are actually mentioned, and the great cities, your great European cities of Worms, Mainz, and Speyer, Ramayja, Magenza, and Spira were the cities that were destroyed when the religious Christians marched through and really destroyed all Jewish settlements in their way as they marched ostensibly towards the Holy Land. And it was a great period of suffering and tragedy. Many Jews lost their lives on Kiddush Hashem at that time. And to mitain Rosh Yimayim, if my head were made out of water, so then I would have the appropriate amount of tears for this tragedy. Now, what's important about this, one could ask, the Crusades did not happen on Tisha B'Av. However, there is a reference towards the end of this kinnah. It says, V'chi ein lo hoskid moed shever v'tav era. There are those who point, the Brisker Rav and others pointed to this phrase in the kinnah to indicate that Tisha B'Av is the day of mourning all tragedies that befell the Jewish people. And that's why we speak here about the Crusades. This was a whole question, which I'm not going into now, but at the aftermath of the Holocaust, should there be a special day called Yom HaShoah to commemorate the Holocaust? Should there not? Is it appropriate? Is it not appropriate? Again, it's an issue that has many ramifications, but according to this kinnah, that's what they say, the Brisker Rav quoted this when they asked him about establishing a day in commemoration of the Holocaust. It ain't lo siv moed shever tamer. We don't add such days to our calendar, but rather Tisha B'Av is the day to mourn that as well. We'll say later the kinnah for the kedoshim from the Holocaust as well, because in a certain sense all tzoros are rooted in Tisha B'Av, right? In other words, they don't need every disaster, every tragedy that's befallen the Jewish people in Golas is a result of Tisha B'Av, and therefore it's appropriate, even though the events may or may not have exactly happened on Tisha B'Av. There are, by the way, many events that did happen on Tisha B'Av. We don't have to go through that now. But even those that didn't can be properly mourned on Tisha B'Av as well, because that's the root of all our trouble. Just one other comment on this kinnah, and that is that in the Sefer Seder HaDoros, the history book written by Talmidim and Balazim, he mentions that the city of Ramayja suffered the most of all the three cities. Was the people of Worms and that community that was most impacted by the Crusaders. And he suggests that a reason behind this, and he has some evidence for it, that in that city they had declared, it was an old city, an old Jewish community, and they'd gone there apparently even after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, one of the oldest Jewish communities outside of Eretz Yisrael. A small group of Jews left after the Churban Bayis Rishon, and when word came to them that the second Beis HaMikdash was being rebuilt, they decided to stay put. They say, you have the great Yerushalayim, but we have a small Yerushalayim. And they sort of lost touch with the importance of Yerushalayim. We heard in subsequent times, Berlin is our Jerusalem, and we know the tragedy that resulted there. So there's also a lesson here never to forget what the real Yerushalayim is and where our Yerushalayim is, and not to get too complacent, even if we're comfortable in other locations. The next king is Oz Baloch Yirmiyo Al Kivrei Ovos, number 26, Chavov. This is based on the well-known Medrash, in which Yirmiyahu goes to the Maros HaMachpelah to plead with the Avos that they should intercede on behalf of Klal Yisrael and the Beis HaMikdash to prevent the Beis HaMikdash from being destroyed. And indeed they attempt to do that. Avram and Yitzhak and Yaakov all speak out. However, Kadosh Baruch Hu answers each one of them, and it's only later, and according to this kinnah, it's called B'chi Leia Rochel Achos Makob and Eve Zilpa Makob and Eve Bila Mekones B'shtei Adar. The Imos Rochel, Leia, Bila, and Zilpa cry, and that's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Shulach Bi Bovel Lama Nechem, I've been sent to Bovel myself for you, I'm going to bring about the Golos. Again, we have the way we have the Medrash, it's Rachel, it's Mevaka. Here it mentions Rachel, Leah, Bila, and Zilpa. But there's two comments I wanted to mention here. One, why is it that the merit of Avram and Yitzhak and Yaakov didn't seem to work? You know, they said something, they pleaded with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and had an answer for them. What happened to the concept of Zchus Avos and the like? So, again, the answer is that those things aren't guarantees in light of the behavior of the Jewish people. In other words, we can't always just say, well, you know, Avram did this, Yitzhak did that, Yaakov did that. You know, it's like the person comes to a young fellow gets a ticket or something and appears before the judge. It turns out that the judge is a buddy of his father's. So the judge will say, listen, you know, I'm going to look the other way this time because, you know, your father's a friend of mine. It happens a second time, a third time, a fourth time. After a while, the judge is asked to say, listen, your father is a friend of mine, but still, I can't put up with this behavior on an ongoing basis. If I look, overlook it once, twice, but we can't make this happening all the time, no matter how friendly I am with your father, I have to carry out the law. So the same thing, we come to our Kodesh Baruch and we tell him, listen, I may not be such a good guy, but you're friends of my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, etc. So his merit, so that's good. So that works for a while. But after a while, that kind of runs out, because it's not a guarantee. It's not like we can feel that we do whatever we want, and we always bank on Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It's true that there is a concept called bris avos. The Gemara says that zchus avos can run out, but not bris avos. Bris, in terms of ultimate destruction, is a different story. But individual suffering, that can happen even in the face of zchus avos. Zchus avos can run out, so to speak. However, Kodesh Baruch Hu does respond, according to this kinnah, to the Imahos. And one can ask the question, why is that? Why did Kodesh Baruch Hu didn't respond to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Had an answer in each case to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but not to the Imahos. For those who point out, again, it goes back to the concept of Bechi. The difference in presenting a logical argument, present a logical argument, and give a logical response. But Kol Bechi Leah, Rochel Achos Mevaka Abonam, there's no logical answer. Right? Somebody's in pain, somebody's crying, you have to be moved by it. All the logical explanations in the world aren't going to help. And so therefore, that's the difference. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov may have presented logical arguments. Avraham Avinu said, I underwent 10 tests, and Yitzchak said he underwent this, and Yaakov said he underwent that. Those are all logical arguments. They're logical responses. But when you're dealing with, again, that cry, like we spoke about earlier, by Alleluia, like a shriek, or a cry, weeping, which comes from inside, and the shaman and so on, it's much harder to give a rational answer, and that's what ultimately, quote-unquote, moves, as it were, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say, Hinim Shoveh Golos Beneichem, I'll respond to that and bring your children out of Golos. The next kina, Oz Bimlos Sefek Yofa Kasirza, recounts sort of an unusual type of story. Yirmiyahu Navi comes after the Churban and finds a woman dressed in black, looking all disheveled, and is not sure if she's a human being or some sort of a spirit, an apparition of some sort. And she says, no, I represent Sion and represent other things. Yirmiyahu sort of tells her, eventually HaKadosh Baruch Hu will comfort you as well. But at the very end of the kinna, we find it says, Kum lech Yirmiyahu lama sechshel lech kral avos Aaron Moshe. Yirmiyahu is told, what are you being silent for? Go call Aaron Moshe. That's why there are those who assume that this kinna should actually have been is out of order here. I don't know how the Rosenfeld may have in the other order. Rosenfeld in his English edition switched the order of someone because it seems logical. And here it appears that this kinnah should be before the previous one. What this indicates is that there was some sort of hesitation, so to speak, on the part of Yirmiyahu. And the hesitation probably was a certain sense of shame or embarrassment. After all, he was the leading Jewish figure under whose watch the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. You don't want to be that person, right? It didn't happen under Moshe's watch. It didn't happen under anyone else's watch. And therefore, Yirmiyahu was perhaps hesitant. However, upon being directed, that's exactly what he does. he swallows his pride, so to speak, and does everything he can to try and get HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rescind the decree. He's not successful, obviously. But this concept of the woman representing Tzion, woman in black, is something which again, we've spoken about in past years, where it's almost as though the Jewish people are not are not themselves when they're in Golis. And the Rav noted that sometimes we find that even halacha, when someone appears differently after having been made up, so there are halachic differences. Maybe we'll come back to the point later. But here, when we're in Golis, we're not ourselves. We're disheveled and we're feeling forlorn. And that's exactly what Jimmy O sees in this woman somehow representing Knesset Yisrael, representing Tzion. Now, the fact remains that as beautiful as Yerushalayim is today, in our time, the city's been rebuilt and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, the shame that we feel that it's, don't have the Beis HaMikdash and certain restrictions to our movement in Yerushalayim. Now that's true very much today as well. And a person has to feel that you're not yourself. You can't just continue in this fashion as though nothing is different. Things are different. And even today, sometimes in a certain sense, maybe it's harder for us to feel it today because we go to Yerushalayim, it's a beautiful city and there are people all over the place and shuls and buildings. It's fantastic. But nonetheless, you have to remember in this kinna, Tzion is dark, is black, is disheveled. The absence of the Beis HaMikdash, no matter what's done in Yerushalayim, it's still missing a significant piece. And the way to do that, again, to undo that, is to get Yirmiyahu and others to call the others to petition to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and eventually ask him to be Merachem Tzion Kiva Moed as the Kina ends. Ozbim Lo Sefer. Next kinah begins with the words Eich Tenachamuni Hevel, and each stanza ends with the words Eich Enochem. Here we have a list of different reasons why it's very, very difficult to be comforted. Again, Eich Enochem, how can I possibly be comforted? And again, it speaks about the suffering, and even though so many years have gone by since then, it's as if there's no nechama that's possible. So we'll look for a moment at the concept of nechama, what's meant by comforting. How do you comfort somebody? Are we really able to comfort someone? So we have a mitzvah called nichum avelim, right? So we go to a beis avel and we sit, we talk with the person. Is that bringing the person comfort? I'm not sure. It's not, it's not so simple to say, oh, now I'm comforted. People struggle to know what to say to another one. By the way, as an aside, that may be why Chazal, our tradition anyway, gave us a formula, that you say, because sometimes you don't really know what to say, and it's very awkward. I'm sure we've all been in Bate Ovel, visiting a morning. We want to say the right thing, we want to do the right thing, but sometimes there's a lull in the conversation. The person observing the Avelis, the person who's sitting Shiva, sometimes is like, is on display, so to speak. I have to put on a show and tell the same story over many, many times and not even be sure, did I tell the story to this group that's sitting here already? There's been so many times I've said it over in the last few days and so many people. And it's very, very trying. And is there a sense of comfort? So as I said before, sometimes when there is a loss, a person feels like his whole world has come to an end. That's when we started the kinnis, the kin of Shavas, that the world has stopped and things will never be the same. It's like the sun set in the middle of the day. And the world has ended. So what is comfort? What is nechama? Nechama perhaps is, and this I saw in the book about the kinnis by Rabbi Chil Spiro, suggests that the very first time that the word nechama is found in the Torah, it says, "Vayinochem Hashem ki oseh es ha'odom." There the word nechama is not used with comfort, but rather a change of mind. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we find later, "Vayinochem Hashem al ha'roah asher diber la'asos te'amo," which is the laning for Mincha. Again, it doesn't have anything to do with comfort there, but rather change of heart, change of mind. And what that may mean is that it presents a perspective. Nechama gives a person a perspective. A person feels after a loved one has died that his world is over. But by receiving some form of nechama, it means, well, the world is not over. I can't ever replace that individual properly, but it can be something else in its stead. Life can go on, albeit in a different fashion. When Yitzchak married Rivka, the pasuk says, "Vayinochem Yitzchak achrei imo." Again, at that point, he became comforted. Why? Because the special miracles, the Medrash tells us, Rashi Chumash quotes, that were prevalent in the time of Sarah, and had disappeared when Sarah died, returned when Yitzchak married Rivka, the different nisim in the household, having to do with the candle and the challah and so on, the cloud above the tent. And therefore, perhaps what nechama is, consolation, is an ability to reconsider, right? Right now I'm feeling devastated, but I can reconsider. Here in the Kinah on Tisha B'Av, we say again and again, Eichen Achaim, Eichen Achaim. However, what Nechama means, Nachmu Nachmu Ami, just a few days later, is to reconsider. There is the possibility of moving on. Life is not over. The world has not come to an end. So that's one definition of Nechama, an ability to reconsider. And flowing from that is, I can't ever replace it. We can't ever, the second base Hamikdash won't be replaced. But there'll be a third base Hamikdash. The second base Hamikdash won't come back, but there'll be something in its stead. You can have replaced and not returned. And therefore, the idea of, even though this kinah says Ve'eichen Achaim, it ends with the words Ve'ozen Achaim. There is a possibility for Nechama after all. Right now, we're saying Ve'eichen Achaim. We feel the world has ended, but Ve'ozen Achaim, true Nechama, true comfort, comes about when a person is able to reconsider and sort of replace that which was lost. Never a full replacement. You don't replace, God forbid, a person, but in terms of the focal point of your life, you can reshift your focus. Someone once said to me, I remember when I was sitting Shiva, a person said to me, you never really get used to the fact that this person is no longer here, but you move around it. It's like, you know, there's a hole in the road. As you know, the street in front of your house is a big hole, a pothole in the road. So, you know, it's always there. But after a while, you learn simply to drive around it. You learn how to avoid it. And that's something which is also a source of nechama. Not that you replace the person, but you're able to move on from it. And that's the oz and achem at the end of the kinah. Next kinah, Amarti Shumeni B'chia Marer, is also a kind of a graphic and somewhat bitter kinah, which describes basically the martyrdom of people who had to kill their own children rather than have them fall to the suffering and torture which they would have been subjected to in the hands of the enemy. It's unclear exactly who the author is. There's some who suggest that it's someone during the First Crusade in 1096. But for whatever it was something where people were moser nefesh, and specifically we find again references to the recitation of Kriya Shema. Abay Nishchat Va'av Korei Shema, and Kriya Shema is associated with suffering. Now it's interesting, why should that be? Kriya Shema is a proclamation in belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and somehow it became the tefillah that one says, presumably from the Akiva, that one recites, we discussed it earlier, one recites at the time of martyrdom, because Kriya Shema includes the requirement, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes your life away, you still have to proclaim your Ava, your belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, your love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And sometimes that's difficult, even under what seem to be more positive circumstances. There are records that some of the survivors of the Holocaust, the Klausenberger Rebbe, as well, Rafa lost his wife and 12 children in the Holocaust, and then rebuilt his family, his chassidus here in New Jersey, in Union City. The Klausenberger Rebbe said he had a harder time, in a certain sense, being disappointed that the camps were liberated by the American soldiers rather than by the Mashiach. That the belief in Mashiach and saying Shema allowed people to hold on under the darkest of times. He just says that we didn't have the ending that we expected. That's what shows an incredible level of belief the Jewish people have in the imminent arrival of the Mashiach. So far I've been wrong. I heard a story not that long ago, I haven't heard it, as I say, until relatively recently, that during 1967, when they liberated the old city, Kosel HaMaravi fell back into Jewish hands, so the Rav Goren, we know, was there, the famous Tkiyah Shofar and the Bracha, and many of us have heard recordings of what happened, a tremendously powerful thing. If you haven't heard it, let me know, I can get it to you. But the story that I heard only, or actually read only recently, was that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his colleague known as the Nazir, the Rav Goren's father-in-law, two old Jews, had left word that if they conquer the old city, bring us right away to the Kosel HaMaravi, two of the Gedolei Torah at that time. And I read the story of, some soldiers who were there. One particular soldier was there, I guess they must have printed this around Yom Yerushalayim time. He said that this was a battlefield, And he said that all of a sudden they turned around, and there were these two old rabbis with white beards, like they popped out of the ground. They didn't know how they get there. It turns out they were going to arrange for an armored vehicle to bring them. But the soldiers didn't know that. The soldiers fighting the battle didn't know that. And here they saw these two old men, didn't know who they were right away, in the middle of a battlefield, standing, davening by the Kosel HaMaravi, and this soldier said he was sure that it was Eliyahu HaNavi and the Mashiach. Well, who else could it be? They were so convinced that the Gula was at hand, and they saw nothing else made sense. What else could it be? How else would these two people get in the middle of a battle zone? Again, you heard the recording, you hear the gunfire in the background. I mean, it was a battlefield by the Kosel, and all of a sudden you had these two elderly Rabbanim standing by the Kosel HaMaravi, and they were convinced, until they found out subsequently who it was, they were convinced this must be the Mashiach and Eliyahu HaNavi. It's the only thing that made sense. It just shows the experience that people, in certain situations, we see the Geula as being so imminent, as being right here. So far, we've been wrong, obviously, and it hasn't turned out. But again, even in this kinnah, the recitation of Shema is that ultimate hope that this is going to be the last martyrdom. Sadly, this wasn't, and other ones we've experienced, the Holocaust and so on, wasn't, and it wasn't the time either when they reconquered Yerushalayim, but we hope eventually we will see the imminence of the Mashiach will be something we all understand and we all appreciate, and we'll see firsthand. The next kinnah begins, Monei Shamayim Shchokim is Belucha Kinolam, and here every stanza ends with the word bias. Again, the bias, the capital Beis, is of course the Beis HaMikdash, that's the bias. However, as I mentioned before, I think that part of the, actually I mentioned this last night, that the building of the Beis HaMikdash, the building of the Mishkan, was to enable HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina not to dwell in that place, or only in that place, but rather in every person. Also, the Mikdash v'shachanti b'socham. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says he'll dwell in the midst of the people who fulfill the Asur L'Mikdash. It's not just the place that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to dwell, but in the people. So in that sense, every single person is a bias. Every individual Jewish home is a bias, and that's why it's not a coincidence that when we form a bias at a marriage, we call attention to the absence of the Beis HaMikdash by breaking the glass, by putting ashes in the head of the chosen, and the like. And as well, as I said before, with regards to a bias is something which is personal. If somebody's home, you feel comfortable there. Again, that same theme that we spoke about in the kinnah relating to Ali can apply here to bias as well. However, bias is something which is more permanent, and or has a connotation, anyway, something which is more permanent than an ohel. And therefore, perhaps in this kinnah, as we move towards the end of the kinnahs, the emphasis is on the permanence of the Beis HaMikdash, even when it's not here. The symbolism of the bias, and if we take it a step further, the Jewish home, which is the bias where we have the Shechina's presence as well, where we are mandated to leave a certain part of the house unfinished, as a zeichel l'churban. Some people put up a statement as a Ashkafei Yerushalayim, where they leave a little corner unpainted and so on, or people now have, put up picture of that Gemara at the end of Parakeskas Abatim that says you're supposed to recall the Churban by not finishing your house. Our house, our private homes, apartments, the place where we live, are connected to the Beis HaMikdash, and that's the idea of the repetition over and over again in this kinah of the word bias. And you know, every home, every personal bias can be a Beis HaMikdash in the miniature, not just the Beis HaKnesses and the Beis HaMikdash, but the Jewish home as well as a source where the Shechina will rest, as we said again last night, but also the Mikdash, the Shochanti B'Sochom. Kino Lamed Ma'onei Shamayim. The next kino, Eish Tukad B'Kirbi, the famous, perhaps one of the most famous of all the kinos, despite the fact that it's not clear who the author is. This is the kinah that draws the contrast between leaving Mitzrayim and leaving Yerushalayim, the majesty, the splendor, the glory of the former, the sadness and the tragedy and the wailing that accompany the latter. We know that there's a connection between Pesach and Tisha B'Av. According to the way our calendar is presently set up, the first day of Pesach is always the same day of the week as the day of Tisha B'Av, the Seder night. So this past Pesach was a Monday night, and B'chos Yirke B'Laila, the reading of Eicha, is this year obviously was Monday night, and today being Tuesday. According to some, the reason we have a Beitza, an egg on the Seder plate, is to recall the absence of the Beis HaMikdash and connected to Tisha B'Av. Others disagree. The only Gaon doesn't like that approach, and it's not proper to bring up a Avelus at the Seder. That's not why we do it. But there are some folks who bring that up. So there's this connection, and again, this kinah draws the contrast. What's interesting, and just point out, it keeps speaking about Bitzesi, Bitzesi Mitzrayim, Bitzesi Mishalayim. It's the stress is on where we're coming from, not where we were going to. And I think that makes the kinah more of a kinah, because we were coming out of some place, and you know, there's a certain doubt as to what happens next. Certain Mitzrayim doesn't say Bivoi Eretz Yisrael or some other such expression. And same thing, not Bivoi Lubavel either. It's Bitzesi Mitzrayim, Bitzesi Mishalayim. It's leaving, it's departing, and there's a certain amount of lack of clarity. And yet, when they came out of Mitzrayim, because they were accompanied by Kadosh Baruch Hu, the question never came up. What do you mean, where we're going? Wherever it is, I'm following Kadosh Baruch Hu, following Moshe. Bitzesi Mishalayim, however, in addition to leaving, it was a question of where are we going, where are we heading to, and that's somewhat of a poignant point. But again, this kin is easily understood, and it's very, very meaningful, and it drills home the point at the end that eventually there'll be Beshuvali Rishalayim, when again we'll focus on where we're heading. It won't matter where we're coming from, but rather the ultimate will be Beshuvali Rishalayim. We'll know where we're going and where we're going to be. Eish tukad v'kirbi b'halos alivi v'tayisim imitroyim kini mo'ira l'maski rab v'tayisim v'shalayim oz yashir moshe shilo yinoshe v'tayisim imitroyim v'konei v'yavnoim
Sgulas el kuchok tzal tibcha, b'tzeisi mirushalayim.
Chagim v'shabosom shemosim v'yosom v'tzeisim in Yisrael Kainis v'yeikam Dov ha'em v'tzeisim Yerushalayim Tovo olim l'arbo v'golim v'tzeisim in Yisrael Olay shmeilim machnos harayim v'tzeisim Yerushalayim Yovel shmita v'eret shoketa v'tzeisim in Yisrael Ochor latzmitzos v'chorros v'chosos v'tzeisim Yerushalayim Kapores v'horon v'amnei zikaron v'tzeisim in Yisrael Moshe Yireinu V'Aaron Yadcheinu B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim Nebuchadnezzar V'Andronus Kesor B'tzeisim Yerushalayim Na'arov Nochomo V'Adonai Shomo B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim Avinenu Hidei Einenu B'tzeisim Yerushalayim Sisrei Poroches, Sisrei Marechet, B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim, Shemon Teches, Olai Sorechet, B'tzeisim Yerushalayim, Olo Zvochim, Rishay Nichochim, B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim, Cheren Nikorim, B'nei Tzion Nikorim, B'tzeisim Yerushalayim. Pare Migbos, Lechavod Migbos, B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim, Shrikos, 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 B'tzeisim in Yerushalayim. Tzit, Azov, Am Shel Rav, B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim, Ushlach HaNezer, Ofas HaNezer, B'tzeisim in Yerushalayim. Kedosh al Nehua, Chor Adonai Nira, B'tzeisit Mitzrayim. Vora Mora, Veruach HaTuma, B'tzeisit Mitzrayim. Rina B'Yeshua, V'Chatoso Satrua, B'tzeisit Mitzrayim. Nakas Olov, Nakas Cholov, B'tzeisit Mitzrayim. Shulchan Menorah v'Chalil Uktorah B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim B'tzeisim Yerushalayim Torah Sudah Chlei Achemda B'tzeisim in Mitzrayim Sasai v'Simcha v'Nos Yagal v'Nava v'Shuvil Yerushalayim.
Next kina at Osai Shoflu. This tries to describe what has been lost as a result of the Churban. And the truth of the matter is, again, it was palpable to people in the absence of the Churban what was no longer there, things that we don't relate to really. So again, we cry, the refrain is Oya and Oy Mehayalanu throughout this kina. And there's a list of different components of the Beis HaMikdash and different things of which we've only read and we've only learned about in Psukim or in Mishnayos and in Gemaras. Something itself to cry about, the fact that we can't really relate to it, and the fact is that we sometimes fail to appreciate the magnitude of the loss, and that's what this kinah tries to summarize or presents all the different aspects of the different things that are in the were in the Beis HaMikdash. And each one of these things had its own significance in terms of spirituality, in terms of the avodah of the Beis HaMikdash. And again, upon reflection, all one can say in this kina is Oya and Oyma Halanu. It's too bad, and how woe unto us, woe unto what has befallen us. When you look at everything in its total picture, it's difficult to do anything but to cry out. There's no answer, no explanation, and very difficult articulation. We summarize the different parts in Kalim and different things in the Beis HaMikdash, but we no longer have them. And today,
we can't even appreciate them, and therefore all we can really say is Oya and Oy Mehalano. Etzpos Hashofar. The next kinna is a shorter kinna relating to the Crusades. We already discussed earlier great length of the details of the Crusades. This is a shorter one. I suspect it's placed here because it has a similar refrain, Oya li, Alalai li. The previous kinna had Oya and Oyma Halano, again, that cry. We don't know what to say. The people who experienced the Crusades, to them, their suffering was similar to the suffering in the days of the Churban. And therefore they too had no answer and no real means of verbalizing, rather cried out, Oyoli and Alalai Li. This kinna was actually written by a nephew of Rabbeinu Gershom, the famous Rabbeinu Gershom Mar Hagola. Again, he was alive at that time. And again, he wrote this as a means of crying out and requests for Kosh Baruch Hu somehow to overturn it and to awaken, so to speak, and to do justice to those in memory of those neshamas who will perish. And again, the refrain of Alalai Li Oyoli gives a sense of how the people felt at that time as well. The next kin is the detailed presentation of the story of the killing of the Navi Zechariah, which took place approximately 250 years before the Churban Habayis. This kinna was composed by the great Yehuda Levi and described in poetic terms what happened when the Jewish people actually killed this Navi, who was also a Kohen. Again, difficult to imagine such a thing happening, but we know the story, the bubbling blood, which did not cease to bubble until many, many, many people, some 940,000 people were slaughtered, according to the one reckoning, by Nebuzradon at that time, to sort of get the blood to stop bubbling. This is Zechariah. This is not the Navi Zechariah for whom there's a Sefer called Zechariah. The Navi Zechariah for whom there's a Sefer called Zechariah in Treyosar, that's a later Zechariah who lived at the beginning of the Bayi Sheni period. This is Zechariah ben Yehoyada, who tried to protest when the Jews brought the Avodah Zarah into the Beis HaMikdash, and actually he was killed by the masses. And he was a Kohen, and he was a Navi, he was a Dayan, and according to the Medrash, it took place on Yom Kippur, which was also Shabbos, and in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash itself. And that blood, as I say, bubbled for all those years until Nebuzradon slaughtered so many people. Actually, the Gemara says Nebuzradon eventually himself converted to become Jewish, by an interesting twist of fate. But in any event, this is the story that was alluded to already a couple of times, and it's actually alluded to in the Megillah when it says in Yareg, the Mikdash Hashem Kohen Benavi. So that event, even though it took place sometime before the Churban, is very directly connected, connected to it. The next kinnah, which is the last before the series of kinnahs that begin with the Tzion, is Shkuras V'lo Miyayin. Shkuras v'lo miyayin, referring to the Jewish people as drunk, so to speak, but not with wine, but rather with all the tragedies that have befallen us as a people. However, with all of that, this kina ends, and like I said, it's the last in the, before the series of those that begin with kina, with tziyam, the kina being the tziyam. But towards the end of the kina, we find the statement kina falti kanti v'Hashem azarani. Even though we have fallen down, we shall once again stand up. That's based on a pasuk in Treyasa and Sefer Micha. And, perhaps it can be interpreted not only though we have fallen will arise, but because we have fallen. That somehow there's a refinement process. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu sort of lays the groundwork for the next greater level, even in the suffering of the first level. And so therefore we have a tradition, as we know, that the Mashiach, as is mentioned in Medrash Necharav, Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. The Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, but the Mashiach is born on that day. And the seeds for an even brighter and greater future are already planted together with the suffering and the tragedy. They say that Rav Schwab used to like to point out that when the Christopher Columbus set sail for the United States, for what would become the United States, when we become America. He actually didn't come to the United States, he came to the southern part, Central America, but again, the New World, so to speak. He set sail right after Tisha B'Av. That was the Tisha B'Av on which the Jews were expelled from Spain. That was the year that, 1492, Tisha B'Av was on August 2nd, and as Columbus set sail, it's a question whether Columbus was Jewish, or he had Jewish crew members, but in any event, they set sail on August the 3rd. And therefore the New World was discovered, of course, that year, 1492. Well, obviously, as Schwab pointed out, the New World, the United States, would be a place of salvation for the Jewish people many centuries later, when Jews had to flee Europe in the time of the World War II. They were able to come, many to America, and save their lives. And so it's as though HaKadosh Baruch Hu planted the seeds way back then, right? Tisha B'Av of that year, what a tragedy. The Jewish people expelled from their home in Spain. And by the way, the Jews, as we know, in Spain had risen to a very high level of prominence in the Spanish community and so on, including Jews who were leaders in government, like Abarbanel and others. But here they were driven out of Spain on Tisha B'Av of 1492, but built into that, so to speak, was the something even greater. And as I mentioned last night, we've been fortunate living here in the United States all these years later to live in a place we've had even greater chesed, greater kindness shown us as a people by the government, that Moshe Feinstein, the Chacham Rambam, described as a machlus of chesed. So this is the notion. Somehow Kadosh Baruch Hu always has the solutions arranged, even at the time of the suffering. And that's the final, really one of the final points of the kinnis before the last set, is this notion that even though we've fallen, perhaps even because we've fallen, we've refined ourselves as a people and as a nation, and we get up again, kinafalti kanti v'Hashem azarani. Shkuras v'lom yayin. Now the next kina lamed vav, begins a series of kinos that start with the word Sion. This one, Sion Halo Sishala Lishlama Sirayach, was written by, again, by Yehuda Levi. As the hour is late, we'll say the next several kinos back to back. I won't introduce each one. All of them begin with Sion until we get up to the till Mem Aleph, till number 41, Shali Suf Beish. I just will comment or two about that. But just the general notion, or the general idea, of these kinos, or Soloveitchik explained, is that there are really two aspects to the requirement to recall Yerushalayim and Sion. There is the idea of Zachra Yerushalayim Yemei Anya Umudeha. Yerushalayim remembers its time of suffering and sadness and so on. But Kol Machmudeha Shehayim Nekenem. But there was also there was beauty, there was charm, there was wonderful qualities to Yerushalayim as well. Now it's interesting, I just throw out for your thinking, the tension that exists when we think about Yerushalayim, we long for Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim exists on a spiritual plane, obviously, but it also exists on a physical plane. I know somebody who, an American person now lives actually in Yerushalayim, but he went to Yerushalayim to visit, I think, one of the first times He said it bothered him so much that there was garbage on the streets and it was, stuff scattered about. How could this be Yerushalayim? But of course, Yerushalayim is also a city, right? I mean, it's a place where people live and you need to have municipal services and whatever else accompanies a normal city. And it sort of have a tension between Yerushalayim, the dream, and Yerushalayim, the city where people live and have normal daily lives. These kinos here describe different beautiful attributes of Yerushalayim, both spiritual and physical. And of course, the opening phrase, Tzion Halos Yishale, you have to inquire about it, but it's more than inquire. I think it means, in a certain sense, to long. We have to long for Yerushalayim, long for Tzion, and feel a special connection when we're near Yerushalayim, we go to Yerushalayim, and we hear about Yerushalayim. Today, it's not something that's impossible to attain. At one time, it was only a dream. People couldn't even imagine it. But now people can go travel, and you can actually go on websites and see what's going on in Yerushalayim now in real time and whatever else. But these kinos describe some of the beautiful qualities of Yerushalayim, of Tzion. And that's the Tzion of dream. And that's the Tzion that we long for. It doesn't necessarily exclude the Tzion of reality. But I'll call upon him as we come to the close of the Tisha B'Av, Kinnas, we focus on the beauty of Tzion. It's interesting, in this vein, Soloveitchik noted, and we've spoken about this in the past too, that there are different aspects, or different ways to remember Yerushalayim, to remember the Beis HaMikdash. Two different types of Zecha L'Churban, if you will, in Halacha. Sometimes we have a Zecha L'Churban, which is modeled after doing what they did in the Beis HaMikdash. So for example, Lulav Kol Shiva. Right, we take Lulav all week of Sukkot, even though the Torah only requires it the first day, because that's what they used to do in the Beis HaMikdash. On the other hand, there's some form of Zecha L'Mikdash where we actually avoid doing what they did in the Beis HaMikdash. So there's some who say, for example, Sfiras HaOmer, that the basic mitzvah, you don't have to count both the days and the weeks, because that's what they did in Yerushalayim. We want to note the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's an interesting point. And the Rav noted they come from different psukim. There's a pasuk which the Gemara quotes in Sukkah, Tzion he darish ein la, miklal de boi drisha, the Gemara in Sukkah daf membeis, explaining why we take the lulav all 7 days. That's because we want to replicate what they used to do in the Beis HaMikdash. On the other hand, there's the other pasuk which the Gemara quotes, daf samach membeis and baba basra, neshkachech Yerushalayim tishkach yemini, that's when we want to refrain from certain things. That's where the Gemara speaks about refraining from meat and wine. Doesn't say it with regards to the 9 days specifically, but that's what the Gemara speaks about that, or about not painting part of the house and so on. Different aspects of remembering Yerushalayim. In any event, these kinos here, the next several, again, we'll say straight till 41, Charlie Super Beige, describe some of the beautiful aspects of Yerushalayim, both physically and spiritually. Continue with the Kina Shali Sufavesh, number Mem Aleph, which interrupts a series of the Tzion Kinos. Shali Sufavesh, of course, is a kino was composed by the Maram Rutenberg following the burning of the Talmud in the year 1242 in France, when 24 cartloads, wagon loads of Gemara and Mepharshim and so on, including, by the way, manuscripts of Baliatosis, which were lost forever, were burned and destroyed. Ram Rutenberg wrote this kina, and it's a strongly worded kina. He wonders, is there another Torah, which is of course a reference to Christianity, the concept of a New Testament, have you abandoned us completely? And really this kina is for the loss of Torah. First of all, you recall, of course, that there was no printing press in 1242, so any copy of the Gemara or anything else was handwritten, and therefore there were months and months and months of work that obviously went into producing any handwritten work. But aside from that, the concept of the denigration of Torah is also something that perhaps is overlooked on Tisha B'Av. We focus on the Beis HaMikdash, we focus on Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, as we should. But it was also the tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people over the years are a loss of prominence of Torah and downspin in Talmud Torah, certainly, which accompanied many of these destructions. Nonetheless, despite some of the strong words, at the end, Avraham Rutenberg also in this kinnah looks forward to a positive and sort of a rebirth, so to speak, of Torah. Today, of course, where we have the ability to promulgate Torah through the printed word and you know, through other medium means today, so it's something you couldn't even imagine. But there's been that rebirth of Torah, and is deeply disturbed as we are by such an event where so many wagon loads of our books were burned, and of course there were book burnings done by the Nazis and so on as well. Nonetheless, we've emerged victorious from this as well, and that's why the Maharam Gutenberg again ends, O Tadi Badi Shana Yisrael Tikhi, eventually you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, again re-adorn yourself, and perhaps a reference to the Torah, they'll be singing and dancing as the Torah is restored to its rightful place. Shali Srufa Ba'ish. I mentioned before that many, many tragedies took place, whether on Tisha B'Av or connected to Tisha B'Av, befalling the Jewish people over the centuries. And there were always discussions as to whether there should be special days incorporated in the calendar to commemorate these days. But based on the kinna that we discussed earlier, the Brisker Rav and others were of the opinion that, in fact, all Jewish tragedies should be marked on Tisha B'Av. And it's in that connection that the great tragedy that took place in the 20th century, in terms of the magnitude of number of people killed, and dwarfs the other events that took place that we read about and thought about over the course of Tisha B'Av. That is, of course, the extermination of 6 million Jews in Europe at the hands of the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And it's our tradition, our shul, to say two kinnas that are printed in the Art School edition, beginning on page 384. One was composed by the late Baba Rebbe Shlomo Hammerstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, who himself lost everything, including family members and many of his chassidim, but rebuilt the Baba Rebbe Chassidus here in New York, and now beyond New York. And the second one is the kinnah composed by Rav Schwab, Shlomo Levracha, the longtime Rav of the Breuer's Kehilla, the German Jewish community. Of course, the German Jews initially bore the brunt of the Nazi persecution, and it's appropriate, certainly, regardless of what one holds about establishing another day, not establishing a day, it's a discussion for a different time, but certainly on Tisha B'Av, it behooves us to mourn an event that took place, if not in our own lifetimes, those of us in the room, most of us certainly in the lifetime of our parents and grandparents. Again, in terms of sheer magnitude, number, it's a staggering thing, and it behooves us to recite those two kinnos. Again, the one composed by the Baba Rebbe and the one composed by Schwab, beginning page 384, and after that we'll conclude the recitation of kinnos by saying Elit Zion. Zichrona Rekanana. Conclude with Elit Zion, again page 390 in the Art School edition. Elit Zion, comparison of Zion to a woman suffering from the difficulties of birth, again with the hidden Nechama, that eventually the baby is born, so too, we spoke about earlier, in the darkness and despair of Tisha B'Av, there is the idea that Mashiach is born, and eventually we'll see the fulfillment of the purpose that we've awaited for all this time. We see our Oh, we shall see.
Thank you so much.